My name is Rick Robbins. I chair the Blue Crab Advisory Committee, and I'd like to provide a little bit of background before staff starts their presentation. But before I do that, I'd like to welcome Professor Todd Moradi and his class from the College of William & Mary. Thank you all very much for attending. These are undergraduate students that are interested in environmental science and business as well, and we welcome you tonight to participate in the meeting. Just by way of background, before we get started on the discussion of old business, I'd like to run through a little bit of discussion. We don't anticipate, in terms of rulemaking, we don't anticipate entering into rulemaking until we've seen the results of the winter dredge survey, which should be available to us the first week of April. And we are planning, as a commission, to clean up one cull ring regulation at tomorrow's meeting. That's something we discussed last month in this committee, and we've advertised for that, so we'll discuss and plan to take action on that tomorrow. But in terms of changes to the management plan, we would not expect to see substantial changes to the plan this year. As you're aware, the day after this committee met last month, we received the results of the fishing mortality for the year based on mandatory reporting, and Virginia met the target. The target was 34%. We achieved a 37% reduction in female fishing mortality. So the good news was that we did hit the target through a combination of measures, and also part of that, of course, was the result of economic impacts to the crab market last year. Having said that, since we did hit the target, I would not expect to see the need for substantial changes to the management plan this year. However, the status quo has changed. Last year's status quo included a 15% reduction in gear. That increases in a stepwise manner to 30% by regulation this year. Also, last year we had a fall closure. That early fall closure was sunsetted so that it would not be in effect this year unless those regulations are amended. So while we hit the target last year, the status quo has shifted some. And consequently, if we want to optimize the regulations this year, we may need to consider some trade-offs. So I think it'd be helpful for this committee to discuss some preferences before we get into the month of April so that we can go ahead and discuss what the preferences of the committee might be as we do go into rulemaking during that period. But the first order of business, we have the approval of the minutes from the January 2009 meeting. And I did have one amendment. Mr. Dohan is credited with comments on the next to last page in the minutes, and that should be Mr. Dahlheim. Are there any other amendments to or changes to the minutes?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Arnold, on page 3 and page 4, on three different cases, that was me. That wasn't Mr. Arnold.
Okay, and that was, should those have been attributed to you?
Yes.
Okay.
And members present, I don't remember Jeff Crockett being here.
I believe you're right.
I read my minutes.
That's right. Good job. All right, Marshall, thank you. So are there any other amendments to the minutes? Is there any objection to approving the minutes as amended? Seeing none, they're approved by consent. Old business, Jack, if you'd start the discussion on bushel limits, or Rob.
Okay. Good evening. I just wanted to provide some background. If you remember last meeting, staff presented information on bushel limits throughout the seasons, and I think it was a little confusing to some of you, and I know there were some comments, you know, why don't we just wait until October? October's a long way off. And I guess what wasn't adequately explained was that depending on when you have bushel limits and if they are necessary, they were intended to offset the 6% savings provided by the closed season that was in place in 2008 from October 23 on, and October 27 on, excuse me. And that's really all the intention was. Tonight, there are three different things that you'll see. Laura Lee has the information that was presented to you last time. Again, just to give a comparison, so you can see how bushel limits through a season would compare strictly to fall, being October, November, bushel limits only as ways to offset the 6%. In addition, I think Tom Powers last time asked for some weekly comparisons between 2008-2006. We also added 2007 in there, and so you'll have three different situations tonight about bushel limits. The benefit of providing the older version to you again is perhaps when you see the fall bushel limits compared to the all season, maybe there's a middle ground if that's necessary. And as Chairman Robbins indicated, we are all waiting for the April survey, but in the meantime, we're just trying to carry forward as if there is some need to take care of that 6%. So maybe Laura can start off on the older version.
Thank you, Rob.
Okay, good evening. As Rob mentioned, I'm going to first review the bushel limits as applied to the whole year, and we looked at them by gear category, and I'm using the pre-2009 names for the gear categories. There are three charts, and they're showing pretty much everything that's in this table if you see easily. This first chart here that I have highlighted is showing what the pretend bushel limits are currently set at to give the results seen in these other two graphs. The graph in the top right is the percent reduction in female harvest within that gear category. So, for example, for the hard pot 100 or less category, a bushel limit of 13 would reduce the harvest by 7.2% within the crab pot 100 or less harvest. And the graph on the bottom right just shows a comparison of what the original harvest was based on the 2004-2007 average harvest, that was our base year, compared to the estimate under the bushel limit. So, for example, again, the original in this light purple compared to the darker purple, a little bit of difference there is that 7.2%. And we looked at exploring how to get it close to the 6%, and this is one set of options, this suite of numbers here. But for example, you might say we want to make the 500 category set at 40. Set it at 40 for whatever reason. Say, okay, what do we have to do to the bushel limits in the other categories to bring this total back up to 6%? So there would be another set of options that brings you to 6%.
Laura, the comparison for the baseline for years, are we talking in terms of 2004 to 2007?
Yes, that's the baseline.
Okay, and then the follow-up, is this for the whole year or just for the fall?
This is for the whole year. That I'll be showing you the fall.
Okay, so your tiered limits then would be, you had one set that had 13, 22. That was a previous.
Remember.
Was that a previous slide? Okay, thank you. So 13, 22, 31 for the 100, 300, and 500 respectively.
And this particular set was one that brought each individual gear category as close to 6% as possible, but
okay.
This wouldn't be the only set of options.
Marshall.
Can we ask questions as you go?
Yes, question. Well, that's fine. Question to the committee. Mm-hmm. Marshall.
When you're basing it on, for instance, the 500 pot,
mm-hmm.
is that 500 pots back then or a reduction now? We can't fish 500 anymore.
No, I'm using the old gear category labels. Someone will have to tell me what the...
So using the old gear.
The old name.
Not present.
Right, but Laura, you're using catch data.
Right.
This is relative to catch.
When it was...
From the baseline.
500, because it's coming from the years 2004 to 2007.
Ken?
I think what Marshall's saying is that in 2004 through 7, you could grab 500 pots, and now you won't be able to grab.
Right.
Last year it was 425. This year it would be 450. So
that's my question. You know, what are we basing it on?
Right. But I think to clarify, this is an output control, not an input control. This is a catch control.
Which okay. You catch less with less pots.
Yeah. That doesn't stand. That doesn't stand now.
This has nothing to do with the number of pots that you're allowed. This is looking at that particular pot category and see what this is and say, if you limit that pot category to that number of bushels through the whole season, what reduction do you get?
But you didn't take that 500.
Go ahead,
Mr. Check. You didn't take that 500 gray pot license and reduce it by 15%. That catch. That's what I'm saying. That
right.
This is just what you say for bushel.
But you're looking. You know,
Rob, did you have a follow up comment?
Well, I don't think everything's as straightforward as that anyway, because maybe with the 500, fishermen are setting the max. But when you look at the other categories, 300, 100, 150, 200, remember, they're up to that amount. A lot of the reports that come in indicate less pots of fish. So there's probably, except for the 500, there's probably not a straight look at this from the reduction of 15%. In a lot of cases, those reductions are taken voluntarily by seeking to fish less pots.
Tom?
Two things. One, to follow your logic about less pots actually being used or capable, that would make the reduction on the watermen actually less, but the overall reduction is still, who knows what it means. A question about how you did your data is, I assume all the other sheets that are on the bottom are day-by-day landings by individual type of numbers or distributions of that, so that you could come up with this actual, what the actual reduction was? Or is this reduction based on the average landings per day, or how did you work that?
I actually took each individual's harvest on a day, 2004, 5, 6, and 7, had it laid out, applied the bushel limit to what their observed harvest was, and then calculated the average over those 4 years and compared it to the average previous to the bushel limit.
So each one of these points is several hundred thousand actual data points.
I don't know about 100,000, but a lot.
Several tens of thousands.
Yeah.
Okay. I tell you what, Laura, you've probably got several scenarios like this. Do you want to?
This and the next is the fall bushel limit.
Okay, can you run through that, and maybe we'll hold the rest of our questions for that.
Okay. This worksheet is exactly the same to the previous worksheet, except that the bushel limit is only being applied to October and November. Peeler pot catch is really negligible then, so even though that says 35, it really is no bushel limit. It just has to be set at that just for calculation purposes. But again, when trying to set it so we get a total reduction of 6% and making each individual gear category as close to 6% as possible, these are the bushel limit that I got across the categories. Again, you can ignore the peeler pot. And the percentage reductions for each individual category, and again, the expected change in harvest. Like the other worksheet, this can be varied to look at different combinations and how that would result in your total reduction, which I think I forgot to point out was this cell here, reduction from our magic original number. If there's any questions on this worksheet.
Questions for Laura from the committee? Laura, this scenario is, again, October and November, applying those limits, catch limits just to that period of time. Mm-hmm. One thing we did discuss last month was the fact that this analysis would be confounded to some degree if under-reporting were occurring. In other words, your conservation effect here is essentially a 6.1 reduction in catch. But if under-reporting were occurring, it would, in fact, be larger. So I know that's something at this point, we don't have any official estimates of non-compliance that I'm aware of. Do we, Jack? Okay.
And also recoupment wasn't factored into, you know.
Okay. Questions of Laura? Marsha?
When you mentioned about underreporting, were you speaking of underreporting on your catch or underreporting on amount of pot sale?
Catch.
You actually fish.
Underreporting of catch. Because what we have here is a projected conservation savings of 6%. But if catch were underreported by 10% and you had catch limits that went into effect, in fact, the conservation effect would be greater. So this would understate the actual conservation effect. And that's one of the difficulties. That's one of the difficulties. Doug, did you want to comment?
Well, this goes from 2004 to 2007, right?
That's the baseline.
So that's 3 years. But how can you evaluate anything or be precise if you say that was underreporting? Well, they most likely were done for 3 years if they were in.
Well, that's the point. We don't have an official estimate of that.
Then you have no negative comments toward the plans and statistics, but I know a lot of watermen now in my association. They'll get reports back saying they haven't reported, and they say, yes, I have. And then after they dig in it a little while and check, they do find out that they do. So we use, more than try to make it, sometimes we're using these figures too close to predict something of them when in reality, we got a lot of ifs. What I'm pointing on here.
Other questions from the committee? Pete,
you projecting this is a limit for October, November, right?
Right, just applying to those months.
What is the projection of a 215 crab pot, a 210 crab pot license for that month of October, November? Can you project that?
That would be. Is that the old 300 license?
Yeah, it's the old 300 license. I don't have 300 license no more.
So that would be this second column here. And here, to get it as close as I could to 6% for that category, was setting it at 8 bushel limits, 8 bushels for October, November.
Any other questions for Laura from the committee on bushel limits?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Pete.
What are you trying to get at by breaking this down as an all-year limit or an October-November limit? Would those be the two options we'd have the other limit year for the whole season or have no limit early on and then this in the fall?
Yeah, the idea is to present a range of scenarios just to see what the numbers would look like if we consider tiered bushel.
That we've come up with so far.
Yes, and that's the idea, Pete. I don't know if you were here when we started, but we don't anticipate significant changes in rulemaking this year.
Yeah, no, I was here for that.
Yeah, we may need to make some trade-offs, and so we've already set in regulation that the length of the season would be restored to go through November 30th, and we've heard from so many people that are full-time and the processing sector as well, that the length of the season is really crucial. So we're trying to see how we can take that into account this year. And that may require a slight trade-off because that closed season was estimated to save 6% or result in a 6% conservation effect for female mortality. So the question is if we restore the length of the season and forego that 6%, how might we compensate for that in a conservation-neutral way? And one suggestion was that we consider bushel limits. And we looked at it as a fall option or an all-year option and wanted to see what those levels might look like. Johnny? Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, is it true to say that if the trawl survey comes back not to our liking and we go into this season in the spring and there's a clear glut and no market from weeks on end and into the summer, we're still going to be looking at doing this come fall?
Well, Johnny, I think if we make rules, we'll make them following the winter dredge survey, and frankly, it's clear now that we've hit the target. At the last meeting, we didn't know where we were on fishing mortality, we've hit the target, so it appears that the package we have in place right now is achieving the level of exploitation on the stock that we're trying to achieve. That level of exploitation should be consistent with population growth. We would expect to see a response in the winter dredge survey this winter, and we'll have those results in April. Now, if something happened very differently than that, you talk about a set of conditions in the summer being different than the fall. I mean, the commission could entertain emergency rulemaking, but would have to have a basis for doing that. Other questions for Laura related to bushel limits? Yeah, Rob?
One last step will be to look at those eligible for 2009. Now, it's probably not a large difference from the data set Laura has, but anyone who's eligible for 2009 who also is in this 04 to 07 standard, that should be the final data set. The other comment I have is it should be obvious that the benefit showing the full season versus the fall is that the fall is a reduced amount of harvesters. Off the top of my head, a couple of years ago, it's about 240 or so harvesters by the time you get into the fall months. So obviously, the harvesters who are there in the fall just went through the closed season, and with just a fall bushel limit, they again would go through that process. But it's the reduced portion of the overall population of crabs. And I think that's why we wanted you to see both the full season effect versus the fall effect.
Rob, thank you. Laura, can you go back to the...
Follow up for Rob.
Yeah, go, Chris.
Just one quick question. When you said eligibility for 09, what do you...
Maybe that they can buy a license. There have been changes that haven't been picked up in terms of licenses dropped out, transferred out, whatever the case may be. Yeah. It's not going to be a large change, but nonetheless, it makes it more accurate. We want to know that if you're asking for a reduction from a bushel limit in 2009, it should be from those who are eligible.
Okay. I guess I'm saying.
Thank you, Rob. Laura, do you mind going back to the year-round option? And can you show us a scenario that would result in about a 3% reduction? In other words, if you could ratchet up those limits that you currently have in place.
And once you get it, could you say it out loud so the guy at the other end of the speakerphone can hear
sure.
it too?
This
yeah,
is just,
thanks, Laura.
Making it as close to three as I can. Probably play around with it some more, but here we have the 100 pot category, 18, which gives a 2.9% reduction within that fishery. For the 300 pot category, 28 bushels. For the 500 pot category, 39 bushels. For the 150 pot category, 20 bushels. For the 200 pot category, 15 bushels. And for the peeler pot category, 4 bushels.
All right, Laura, the I wanted you to do that because, we've got some other things in play. I mean, this is just one measure. But one thing that we'll get to later in the discussion under sponge crabs is the fact that, last year when we were making the regulatory package for the year, we had a measure that would have closed the old sanctuary beginning May 1, and that was invalidated. We didn't have the authority to do that under the code. That's statutory, and that has since been amended. That hadn't been signed into law yet, but if it is, then that might be another option, and we don't have a quantitative assessment yet of what the effect of that would be. But if that is, if that might afford just hypothetically a few percent, then you may not have to lean as heavily on this option. And I wanted to see what an option might look like that would simply reduce the harvest by about 2 or 3%, and maybe get the committee to comment on their thoughts on those bushel limits. Just looking at them for 100, it'd be 18. For 300, 28. For 500, 39. For 150, 20. For 200, 15. Ken?
Yeah, a couple of questions. I mean, how does the 200 pot license get allowed more crabs than the 100 pot? And the other is this 15% reduction in gear been projected into these formulas for what we're going to?
No.
This is on the output side, so it's not on the input side. Mm-hmm. Marshall.
I've served on this board for a long time, and historically, we've kind of always been against bushel limits for the fact that we've got Carolina and our neighbors to North Maryland and putting us on a bushel limit, and our neighbors to the south and north of us not having any limit. That strangles us. I'm surprised that John hasn't spoken on that. That's so unfair. If you think about putting Virginia on a bushel limit and allow Maryland to catch as many as you want, that cuts our throat.
Well, that's part of the economics of it, and that's what we need to hear from the committee. But at the end of the day, we've still got to figure out, and we don't have to do that today, but if we want to restore the length of the season, we need to weigh some trade-offs, and this is one possible trade-off. So, if you have alternative trade-offs you want to put on the table, obviously we can discuss those later.
Well, but, this year, now, our catch is way down. We have no catch for January and February, so our numbers are already down.
And that's been factored in.
So not catching any crabs in January and February has already been factored in.
It's been factored in, Marshall, because if you consider last year's fishing mortality, the goal was to reduce it by 34%.
And we've done that.
And we did that. And part of how we did that was through the closure of the dredge fishery.
And now, when you say that is that this year's closing, this year's dredge fishery, up to this point, we've reached 36%?
For the calendar year. The exploitation is for the calendar year.
Which ends in?
December 31.
So January and February of this year hasn't been counted.
But that, Jack, you can comment on that. It's going to go into this year's equation. So.
Actually, the savings from closure of the dredge fishing season in December and in January, February, March of this year enter into the savings from 2008. In other words, the dredge survey that we'll get results of in April will give us a measure of the population at the start of the fishing season this year. March 17th.
So it's possible we've
already taken credit.
Oh.
We achieved a 37% reduction versus 34% because in part we closed the dredge season and everything else.
Jack, that's through March 16th then? Okay. Well, then I'm mistaken. It wasn't calendar year, but it's through, but it is accounted for. Go ahead, Marshall.
It is possible that once this survey comes in March, is that what you told me?
April.
Is it possible that it could be even lower than 36? Or higher than 36?
No, the 37% reduction is the decrease in harvest in 08 relative to the 04-07 average.
I got that.
The survey is going to tell us what size the population is. And if the population has gone up as a result of saving crabs last year, if it's now higher than it was last year, we should be able to remove more crabs from that population. So if it's gone up substantially, we could back off some of these regulations. If it's gone down, we've got to add regulations.
Tom.
So that's why we have to wait. Two
things. Number one, if you're calculating mortality, then what he is saying is true. They did not count the reduction for the dredge fishery being closed January, February, and the first half of March for the 37%. So the 37% was calculated starting March 15th to March 15th? Okay. The second question, and it gets back to this weekly thing on the peeler fishery. I'm concerned that the peeler fishery is not a flat fishery as far as the harvest they have the month of May and the month of August, where it's really big, and that a flat bushel limit on them may be really detrimental to their peak season, and that we need to, and that's why I'd ask for that other data now.
Well, frankly, on that point, Jack, I mean, the fall closure is where we're looking to compensate, what we're looking to compensate for, and that doesn't affect the peeler fishery, so I'm not sure why we have the peeler fishery in the analysis.
Yeah. Okay. Fall, but this is the year round. This is okay. On the year round when I was looking at that. The other question is goes to Johnny, I guess, from a market standpoint. I thought the market was glutted in the spring and not the fall.
It can be glutted year round.
Okay. Yeah, if the market's glutted in the spring, wouldn't you want a spring reduction in the pot limits and not a fall? And I turn to the guys at the other end of the table. Which way is better from the crabber standpoint or worse from the crabber standpoint economically? In the market and your competition.
Let's hear other comments on the bushel limits. Pete?
I just figured out, if she said 8 bushels, that was a 6%, right? Not the 3%.
In the fall, right?
In the fall, October, November. And I figured if I work 22 days in October, November, that might be more than that, but I figured 22 days, that's 176 bushels of females that I could have caught. And when I was crabbing last November, I was throwing 15 to 18 to 20 bushels, sometimes 25 bushels back in the water. And I figured that up, and that 22 days at 15 bushels was 330 bushels. So I still saved over half by throwing back more. If I caught that 176 bushels when I didn't catch, I would have still saved half of the catch. And going back to the 3%, I don't know what you said of what the 3% was. It was 20-some bushels?
18, 28, 39.
Yeah, I didn't figure that out, but that's a good average in November.
That's year-round
now,
right?
No, that's October and November.
Now the 3% was year-round, Pete.
Year-round.
Mm-hmm. Right.
18 bushels for 300 pot license, 215 pots, so they actually 210.
28 bushels for
year round.
Right, for females.
Right. Yeah, all females, everything for females.
But what would be the percentage we'd get for that? Would it be in the savings?
3%.
3% or 6%?
3%.
3%. And what was the 6% for the year round? I know you had it up there somewhere.
22
bushels.
Right.
And what percentage have we got to get up to save to even get October number in there?
6%.
6%.
Assuming status quo,
6%. What is 6% for a peeler?
Page?
Year round.
Year round.
We weren't assuming that the bushel limit would apply to peelers in the fall.
I understood that. October and November, no. No harvest.
Well, the peelers are not, the peelers really aren't central to the analysis. I mean, I don't think they should be because we're trying to compensate. If we compensate for anything, the 6% is the savings that was associated with the early fall closure on the fishery. And that really related to the hard crab pot fishery. So you're trying to save 6% in that fishery. And how do you, how can we craft some other options that do that? Doug?
Well, Tim, I understand we're looking at the reduction in female harvest, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, how you deal with the people that 90% of their catch in the peeler and the hard crab fishery are male crabs? Do you have any formula for that? We got records that will show that in the tributaries of, in the upper part of the bay, Rappahannock, mm-hmm. tributaries of Potomac.
Right. Well, because we don't have sex reported, we assume 50-50. We know that I know you've said that it's 90% males in some areas and some times of the year. We have also heard reports from harvesters that it's almost all females in certain times of the year. And so the best we can go with is 50-50 unless, you know, someone has data or other to show us that a different ratio would be more appropriate.
Right, and right now our reporting obviously is sex-specific on hard crabs but not on feeder crabs.
Right.
And so the data for hard crabs is sex-specific, and the management objectives are female-specific. So those are the numbers we're operating with. Rob?
After the last meeting and the comments about the sex ratio, I contacted Glenn Davis from Maryland Department of Natural Resources, and he said they're doing the same thing, 50-50. He said it's possible that at some point someone could take the surveys that they have an in-field survey, for example, and work that out a little bit better, because obviously early, middle, and late season differences in sex ratios, but the 50-50 has been fairly standard that Maryland uses as well.
Thank you, Rob. And some of the committee, go ahead, Paige.
If we have a low abundance of female crabs, how can it be 50-50? We're already saying we have a low abundance of female crabs.
Well, we do have a low abundance of the whole population relative to where it was historically, but so far the management efforts have been focused on females because we haven't had any evidence yet that sperm is limiting in the population. And in the absence of that, the management objective has been on females, recognizing that females are limiting to the population. Can we have some committee members, though, comment on the viability of some of these bushel limits, like for a 300-pot rig? Pete, you spoke earlier, but at 22 bushels or 28 bushels on a year-round basis, is a 300-pot license viable?
Well, I don't have a 210-pot store. I don't get 28 pots, no 28 bushels anyways, not unless it's a pile of crabs through there.
And if you had 300 pots, would you catch 28 bushels?
I'd probably catch 28 or better.
Thank you. Other comments from the committee on bushel limits? Joe?
I agree with what Pete said, but I have one brief question for Jack, if I may.
Go ahead.
Jack, you said that if the dredge survey comes back favorably, there will be a reduction in restrictions. What numbers are you talking about when you say a favorable dredge survey?
Say that again.
You said earlier.
What do I mean by a favorable?
Exactly. We know the target number is what we consider a favorable number. Okay, so if it was over 200 million, later on 250 million or 275.
What we have to do is, when we get that dredge survey number, that's going to tell us the size of the population.
Right, I understand.
We're going to look at that number and compare it to the 200 million.
Right, I understand.
Then, from that number, you can predict. If you can safely remove 46% of those, that's the safe target level of distribution. If you multiply 46%,
that's the amount of 53 is it, where it's not always best.
How much harvest we can have in 09? You compare that to the harvest we had in 08, and that tells you how you can adjust the regulation. So do we need more of a reduction or less of a reduction?
Thanks, Jack. Any further questions or discussion from the committee on bushel limits? Jack, you want to move on to agency?
Before you move off of that, just if you want to give this more thought and come back next month, remember we can manipulate any one of those numbers and, you know, to determine what percentage reduction you want to get out of it. It may be we don't have to achieve.
Do we have
a 6% or a 3%? Yeah. It could be some other number.
Do we have any draft of that you can pass out?
You can copy that, right? You can give them a copy. It just won't be interactive.
I'd like to have a draft of it.
Yeah,
6%
sure.
And 3%.
For year-round and for the fall?
Yeah. Yep. Year-round and for October and November.
Yeah.
Thank you. That'd be great.
Yeah, I can do that now.
We'll get those before you leave.
Thank you.
This is actually data I was asking.
Right. That's why I wasn't sure if I was to do this now or...
Yeah, you may as well. Yeah, if you still have another item.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Laura.
This analysis was based on something that Mr. Powers asked at the last meeting. I was looking at the average week weekly harvest, and again, I did it by pot category, and this is over the crab season. The top graph is just your effort, and I have it for 2006, 2007, and 2008. The lower graph is the average bushels, and this is female crabs again, per harvester per week. These are weeks of the crab season on the x-axis, and try to give an indication of where you are in the year with these. So we're starting here with the crab pot 100 or less, which is the 211 license category. I'm just going to move through these quickly, and then if you want me to go back, here again, same years, colors match up to the years the same way on every graph. This is the 300 hard pot or less effort on the top again, and the average on harvest on the bottom. The 500 pot or less, the 150 hard pot or less, 200 category, and finally the peeler. I also noticed for 2008, at the time I ran this, the data weren't finalized for the last few weeks in 2008, so the black lines don't run all the way out to the end of the year for the comparisons. There's no questions on those. I have graphs comparing the 2008 weekly averages to 2006 and also to the 2007, as well as comparing 2006 to 2007.
Thank you, Laura. Any questions for Laura on the effort graph?
Well,
Tom, you had requested the data.
Yeah,
do you have a question?
The only comment here is on the peeler fishery specifically. You would think that if we're going to put a bushel limit on there, that we'd want to put something that allows for this peak in the spring when they have their big run, because they count on that economically. On the other fisheries, it would certainly flatten out the harvest some, I would imagine, but they'll still be available 2 weeks later or whatever.
Thank you. Any other questions for Laura or comments?
Mr. Chairman.
Marshall.
We have a bushel limit in the spring.
Sorry?
We have a bushel limit in the spring.
On peelers?
No.
Right. He was commenting on peelers. So, yeah, thank you. Other comments or questions? Thank you, Laura. Jack, if you want to go on to the issue of agency.
I was.
You weren't?
No.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I don't have to show you.
Go ahead.
These graphs, I think maybe more specifically what Mr. Powers was asking for, this set here is comparing 2006 weekly averages to 2008. So those graphs before, but the 2006 value, what it was, minus the 2008 value. So, for example, in week three in the crab pot 100 or less category, the average weekly harvest of females from 2006 to 2008 reduced by about negative 15 bushels. And see, for most these pot categories, it dropped. For the 500 pot, it dropped mostly in the spring and sort of even out. But notice that the scale here is much larger than compared to the other. So you're getting bigger differences, or you have differences between 2006 and 2008. Also, with the peeler, there really wasn't much of a change. And there, again, notice the scale. It's in just units of one there, so really negligible changes there.
But they only averaged two towards the last half. I'm sorry. They only averaged two during the last half of the season. So on a percentage basis, it might be not negligible.
In these text boxes, which I'm sure you can't read, I put the overall change of a 2008 overall weekly average and 2006 overall weekly average, and these have the overall difference in these boxes. Just cut over to, this is differences from 07 to 2008, and similar patterns for the 100, 150, and 300 categories. So the 300, again, it's concentrated more in the spring, like it was for the 500 category between 06 and 08. 500 had a negative impact in the spring and then positive impact in the summer through the fall. Peeler pot, same situation as the 06 to 08. And 200 pot, the negative impact wasn't as much. We also looked at 2006 and compared to 2007, should have showed first, where we didn't have these regulations changing, just to see what was happening. And you can see that's really where you have a lot of negative changes between from 2006 to 2007. So even without change in regulations, there were some negative impacts on, I think, all the gear categories, at least in part of the year. And then I finally done.
Laura, my apologies.
That's fine.
Is there anything else?
No, that's all.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Laura on this data?
We don't need all them.
Pete?
You want copies?
I'll leave the ones that I say.
Thank you, Laura.
We don't need all that.
Yeah, if you could produce those tables for us as a committee so that we can review them. Thank you. All right. Jack, agency.
You'll have to send me back to college and all that stuff, Jack.
Yeah, well, I didn't know what it meant either.
This is what we might be looking at.
Any consolation to you?
To make a decision.
We were asked to do it, and we did it.
You did a good job.
At your last meeting, in your discussions about agents, you asked a question about how many agents there were in 2008 and how many were caught doing illegal crab activity. There were 106 individuals who registered as agents in 08, and there were seven of those individuals were cited for a crabbing violation that ranged from not having the license to obstructed cull rings to crab hunting on Sunday. Those were the typical violations. That's a 6.6% percent of the population, if you will, that violated the law. I had hoped to have a number to compare that to for all commercial fisheries to tell us whether 6.6% is high or low or where. And I don't have that number for you tonight. It's not quite as easy to produce as we thought, but we will get that for you, and that'll give you some idea as to whether it's just sort of business as usual compared to the other fisheries or not. You also asked that we contact the Attorney General to look into the possibility of, when we find an agent who has violated the law and we summons him, can we also summons the license holder for that same violation? The second question was, can we revoke the license when the agent violates the law? And we talked to Carl Josephson, our Attorney General, on those questions, and his answers were that, in general, you cannot cite a license holder for a violation committed by his agent unless you can prove that there was some complicit arrangement between the license holder and his agent. If you could prove that they knowingly, voluntarily, or with common intent, with the principal offender united in the commission of a crime, this is Carl's words, then you could cite both the agent and the license holder. And obviously that's going to be extremely difficult to do in this business. For the most part, all of these laws are misdemeanors, and in Virginia, the misdemeanor has to be committed in the presence of an officer to receive a summons for that violation. So unless you can somehow determine that they conspired to violate the law, you're not going to be able to write the license holder a summons. Now, he did go on to say that you could with changes in the regulation, you could revoke the license from the license holder if his agent, you know, habitually was a violator. You could bring him before the commission. But in order to do that, you would need to adopt a regulation that lays out those procedures, gives basically public notice to license holders that if your agent violates the law to some level, then we will call you in and take your license. The other thing that he said is that serving as an agent is a privilege, not a right, and that the commission has already established reasonable conditions that an agent is expected to abide by in order to serve as an agent. For instance, we require them to register with us. He said we can add additional conditions in the regulation that would apply to the conduct of an agent, such that, just as an example, you could say no person who has violated a crabbing law in the last 12 months shall be eligible to serve as an agent, or any agent convicted of a crabbing violation will forfeit his privilege to serve as an agent. So if, while you may not necessarily in those cases revoke the license that's held by the owner, you could remove that person from operating not only as his agent, but as an agent for anyone else by revoking his privilege. And I think both of those, either license revocation or revoking the privilege of serving as an agent, would go a long way to addressing the problem that you all raised last month. In both cases, Carl suggests we should amend our current regulations to spell out, you know, as clearly as possible what those rules would be. And I'd like to hear your all's thoughts on that, but that's certainly something we could bring to the commission's attention next month and ask for a public hearing in April, along with all the other things that we'll be looking at.
Jack, thank you for reviewing that with the Attorney General's office. It seems that we had some concern that was discussed here at the committee level last month. This has been something we've discussed in the past, discussing agents and the use of agency. And, in federal fisheries, licenses are subject to sanctions if they're being operated by an operator. The owner is also at risk, and I think that was part of the discussion last month. But it seems that, if we considered developing maybe a threshold for sanctioning the agent himself and getting at the eligibility of that agent to serve, such that if they had X number of violations during a specific period, that might be a constraint and deterrent to
it would
that
be
type
helpful
of behavior.
For the committee members to discuss what's the threshold level. I mean, is it one violation? Is it, is it three? Where's the threshold?
Pete, you brought this to our attention at the last meeting. Do you have comments?
Well, I spoke with Jack about this today, and this seemed like a pretty good solution to the problem as I see it. And I spoke with a couple folks up the bay. Rufus Ruart, for one, has been concerned about how to handle his agent situation. And he expressed to me weeks ago that he thought that there should be some responsibility put on the license holder for whatever his agents do. As it stands right now, your agent can go out and break every law he wants, and your license is not in jeopardy, and neither is the ability of the agent to continue working. He can continue getting violation after violation and violation and just keep on going. There needs to be some culpability. I think these two things would go a long ways to solving that problem in the interim period until we actually determine what we're going to do about agents.
Well, I think as Jack indicated, if we want to pursue that as a committee, we need to develop a range of thresholds that might be appropriate. I mean, right now, if somebody's convicted of two crabbing violations within a 12-month period, they're brought before the commission automatically for review.
Well,
and that doesn't trigger an automatic action, but it is a review.
I think that ought to also hold true if your agent violates at the same level. I also concur with the idea that if the agent himself is convicted of a violation, that his privilege to continue being an agent for anyone be revoked. Now, whether that should be a permanent revocation or an annual revocation.
The revocations are subject to a two-year maximum under the statute right now.
So that would be, it would be a two-year maximum.
Other comments from the committee? Tom?
I'm concerned that you could, that it would have, that it would have to be like you worded the before, conservation based. Because what if it, if their pots drift into a channel or get put into a channel, or a moderate number of them? I'm not saying they set the string down the middle of the channel. Do you want them to lose their license or their ability to work as an agent for that violation the first time, Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead, Pete.
How is that set up now? Isn't that a conservation?
It is a conservation measure. In other words, if your pot drifts in the channel, you're not coming in front of the commission.
That's what we're looking for. We're looking for either criminal violations in the form of theft, which some of us run into. Pete Freeman knows one or two of them that we have to deal with on a regular basis that send agents out to maraud where we crab, and conservation regulations, not reporting or pots in the channel or minor infractions like that.
All right, Pete. I've got Marshall.
How widespread is this problem?
Well, you just heard. I think you just heard from Jack as far as what was convicted. He asked how widespread the problem was. I mean, in terms of the citations, it doesn't appear to be widespread. But I think we had some concerns that came to the committee that were specific.
I'd kind of like to know when he stated that he didn't know if that was a normal average for that or not. I mean, if it, we have plenty of regulations. I don't want to be passing a lot of little regulations. We don't really know how big this problem is.
I think the discussion.
I finished it. Pete mentioned theft.
I think it all depends on where you are. You know, in some areas,
Pete,
probably.
Well, Marshall, I think the discussion has raised one important question for us to consider, and that is whether an agent should be treated differently than a regularly licensed waterman. I mean, right now, if a licensed waterman and crab license holder is convicted of two citations, he's automatically coming before the commission for review, and the agent's not being required to do that. So that's, I think that's a fair question. Do you think, does the committee think that's fair? Or should the agent be held to the same standard at least? And should there be any concern for the license holder? If a license holder has, a series of violations committed by agents on his license, should there be some level of accountability for that? That's the question before the committee. So if you want to comment on that, I don't know how widespread it is. We've heard from staff as to how many citations have been issued, and we heard some specific concerns at the last meeting. But I think it does raise a policy question. Should we continue to let that stand?
Did you ask any comment on that, Rick?
Go ahead.
Didn't you ask any comment?
I was responding to you, but go ahead.
I believe in fair and equal to all.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. Mm-hmm. Other comments from the committee on this?
One question.
Tom?
Is the intent of staff to put this regulation on all persons working as agents or just on the crab industry?
Well, I mean, all the discussions we've had in this group have been about the crab industry.
I mean,
the only ones that have to be registered.
Because, I could imagine it having similar problems in other fisheries, gillnet fishery, for instance.
Have agents.
Well, they don't have to have agents because if they're a registered waterman, but if the agent isn't a registered waterman. And we've had discussion in Finfish where people are having a crew go out, take their boat and their gear and go out and during spot season and stuff and such. And
the regulation
is specific now. So maybe,
Tom.
Yeah, that's what I was going to suggest.
Yeah, it seems like right now we've got an irregularity, just an inconsistency in the policy, and so just as a sort of an interim step, it might be appropriate to go ahead and consider at least developing, making the requirement the same for the agent as it is for a licensed crabber. But is there any more interest at the committee level in developing other measures that would apply to the license holder? Go ahead, Pete.
Jack, my opinion on the age is concerned, you know, I had one work with me last year when I was had my heart attack. And he come to this commission before Jack, and he signed papers. So, in fact, he's the same thing as me. He's buying a license to go to work. And if he's working under my license, which he got a ticket, I went to court with him, and that's the way it should be. The license, he holds my license. I should have went to court with him, and I went to court with him. Of course, they didn't find me. They threw it into court because it wasn't fine to start with. But if it should be put in there, a regulation that if it's an agent caught off my license, I should go to court with that agent. And I think that law enforcement officers should be advised of that. Because that's the way I had to do it. I did that in Norfolk. And I don't know whether I was supposed to or not, but I went anyway.
Jack.
You weren't actually summoned to be...
No, no, I wasn't, but he was. He was.
Help your agent.
Yeah, I went to help the agent.
And what the Attorney General has said is if he catches an agent violating the law, he cannot, under the law, summon you to court. He can only summon the agent violating the law.
That's what happened.
That's the problem.
Mm-hmm. That's what happened, and I went to court for all his benefit.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Pete.
The thing about it is like it is, if Pete, if that, whoever was working your gear last year, if he got convicted of a violation, he could get a ticket and get a fine.
Right.
But that's all it would be.
Yeah.
It would not apply to...
It would apply to my license. Though.
No. No. Yeah. It would apply to nobody but him in the court. It has no cumulative effect like we have if you were working your gear. You got me? It's a free ride for whoever uses an agent to never put their license in jeopardy for as many infractions as their agent gets. Their agent could go out and get a ticket every week, and as long as their fine is paid, they can just go right along and do whatever they want to do. Is that good or bad?
No matter how egregious.
Well, do we want to, as a committee, pursue that? Or, you know, it seems that, we have... You know, this one issue has been raised about the inconsistency. So perhaps we could have staff come back to us with the exact language in the regs right now and, propose a modification to make them similar that we could entertain as a committee at the next meeting and discuss that. But does the committee want to further pursue this idea of sanctioning in some way at some threshold the license holder? Chris?
Yeah. I think we should at minimum make it similar for the agent as to what we already have on the books for the license holder.
And another thing,
Pete,
I'd like to check to see how many watermen rather got tickets last year, regular watermen.
We will.
Against the agent. Against the agent. They will know what the percentage is.
Mr. Jenkins?
Oh. I'd like to have some clarification on the agent. Does the agent have to be a U.S. citizen or can it be anyone?
Jack? Further comments from the committee? Jack, why don't we at the next meeting, if you could develop some language that would address that issue, and then we can put it back to the committee and discuss whether we want to pursue that on a regulatory basis. And if the committee has further concerns in the future about the license holder, we can discuss those as well.
Mr. Chairman, I have
Tom.
One follow-up question to that comment about U.S. citizenship. Does a person have to have a right to work in the United States to get a waterman's card or work as an agent at all? I mean, if I had a company and an illegal alien came up and worked for me and I knowingly let him work for me and paid him, I could get in trouble with the INS. The Immigration Service. Now,
we don't check the immigration.
No, so there's no right to work check done on anybody. That,
Tom.
Doug, is where you need to push it at the legislature.
Well, it is an issue with the Coast Guard when it happens federally. So.
Oh, it certainly is.
Let's, right. Let's move on to license stacking, Jack. I don't know that we're going to solve any immigration problems tonight. Thank you.
Okay. Unfortunately, the way these are stapled or they're out of order, so I prefer that you look at the second page. And back in August, 6 months ago, staff presented this information to you. At the time, there were thoughts that if there were pot tagging, then there could be pot transferability. And you looked at the same information. It was set up a little bit differently. The only difference was that there were 10% intervals throughout the chart. And I think some of the things that were said at the meeting back in August were maybe that it would be difficult to show what full time really meant in terms of days worked. That hasn't gone away, but I think you can see clearly from this frequency distribution of hard pot harvesters that a large majority, 776, are probably what you wouldn't call full-time crab harvesters, whereas it might become questionable whether you think from 78, 79, 80 days on, the top 50% is more full-time. And again, I think what was talked about more recently is there is a need for some who would like to upgrade, that there needs to be some way to know that those upgrades won't result in transfer of effort, so that you have someone who barely used their gear transferring to someone who's very active, and you know that can result in extra effort, obviously. I think that you know, you'll never quite come to terms with exactly how much change there is area to area, because that was another comment back from August, that you might have someone who's fishing in one area and with a certain amount of gear and doing a certain level of performance, but put that gear in the hands of someone else in another area and things may change. I think that would be difficult for anyone to really address. So I think the main idea is, at this point at least, if there are going to be some kind of transfers of pots, where do you think that should take place in relationship to these types of frequency distributions? If you look at the next page, it's really page 3, that shows the peeler pot distribution. And I'm sure there are some who might say of that 383 with 27 days or less, that that may be their full-time season. Whereas you see the tails getting, you know, more than about 91 days, well, they're switching the type of potting that they're doing, and they're just out there. That's what they want to do. So it might be a little more difficult on the low end here, the 25% and a little bit less, to make a distinction as to what would happen if those pots were transferred up the line. The last two charts, which are the first page and the fourth page, are helpers. And at this point, we haven't included the helpers within the main population of hard crab potters or peeler potters. The helpers are cardholders. They're individuals who have a commercial registration license. They work with someone else. The primary does the reporting and submits the helper's name along with his report. It can be very cumbersome to try and dig that out, but Stephanie, who I saw is back there, has a knack for being able to do that. This all started back with striped bass back in 1996, the idea of helpers. What you also might find with helpers are primaries. So some of these helpers also serve as primaries at certain times. So it may be that we'll look at this by just blending them in somehow, but there could be some double counting where a primary and a helper are the same individual. But we wanted to give you an idea that there are helpers out there. They're not numerous, In the peeler pot, looks like you're looking still at about 100 individuals. If you look at the hard pot, if I can put my finger on it, should be the last page. Yeah, the last page, quite a few, you know, 250, let's say. So we would have to do something more, another turn on this to figure out how to put the helpers in with the regular crab potters, and might have to do it in such a way that if you're in as a regular crab potter, you won't be in as a helper. But if you're just a helper, you'll be in with the mix with everyone else. I think that's the way to kind of look at it at this point.
Rob, a couple of questions just in terms of whether or not this is a viable option. You know, is this viable in two terms? Is it viable administratively to administer the transfers? I know we discussed this last year in the context of pot tagging. And also, the second question, is it viable from a technical standpoint to use these data bins to develop a conversion factor so that we could have a conservation neutral transaction occur?
The latter, it would be terribly difficult, I would think, to remain conservationally neutral. It's similar to before, that as you look through the years of transfers, when they started up, that a transfer usually results in additional effort. You know, someone does not buy a license just to sit on it. I mean, it does happen, but in general, that generates more effort. So you would assume that any transfers of pots would be to the benefit of the person receiving the pots. Administratively, it would just be a matter of setting what levels were acceptable for what type of upgrades or what type of transfers, and then there'd have to be some forms drawn out. It'd have to go through the same process that we do with regular transfers, through a notarization process of the two parties. You know, it's fine that way. I think the hard part is you would hope that this scenario was in place when the stock itself was more robust. And we're proposing it now without even knowing the April results. And the entire Bay community is saying, let's get to 200 million crabs, which is of age one and greater, which is just an interim abundance. It's really not looked at as an endpoint at all. It's just an interim level. So I would think you'd want to see at least 200 million. And what we have in the regulation for the waiting list, those on the waiting list are 3 years of 200 million, consecutive 3 years. So I think it's a good thing, maybe when conditions are better with the stock. It's debatable whether you want to jump right into this now.
Right. Well, from a technical standpoint, though, if we assume that any person transferring a license, that the new holder of that license was going to fish at the mean level of effort in the full-time category, if you make that assumption, which would be a conservative assumption, and then look at their historical basis of participation prior to the control date, you could develop some conversion factor, could you not?
We could certainly look at it, yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
All right. Questions from the committee?
The problem we have, though, is, you know, you have the same problem that a few people have pointed out tonight. That magical relationship between effort and harvest is something that's very elusive. You know, the 15% reduction in pots and the 30% reduction in pots, you really don't know with overcapacity. And the overcapacity is not simply the fact that there's too many pots. It's also in relationship to the level of stock. Because if we had, 400 million age 1 plus crabs, having 380 to 400,000 pots out there might be perfectly fine.
Buck, my take on that is the same as it was last summer. I don't even know why we're discussing it. Originally, you said that 547 latent license holders, if the crab population had came back, that was a threat to the population by putting more of them in there. And then you went on back of that and talking about taking those that you've taken out of the fishery and giving them back to the fishery. So, you know, it really don't, plain simple math, we shouldn't even be even discussing it now. wait till the population come back and then address it.
Doug, the only licenses that would be eligible for transfer are those that are active. So waitlisted license would not be eligible for transfer. And the idea was, the reason to discuss it was to try to mitigate the impacts or see if we could develop an option in the absence of pot tagging that would allow us to mitigate the impacts to individuals associated with the 30% reduction in gear that's currently on the books.
It was discussed back then about this because a couple of them on the committee down there brought the fact up that to those who had a 100-pot license or 200-pot license, it would help them to increase their gear, is what I understood. But you at that meeting, Ken? Yeah. Wasn't that the logic? Yeah. Huh?
Yep.
That's what I understood. I mean,
that's what the intent was.
Any other comments from the committee? Joe?
I have a comment. It's viable licenses that people will be eligible to get this year. But of the licenses people were going to be able to get this year, a certain percentage of those licenses have not been used in the last year or two and perhaps would not be used this year and would instead be sold to VMRC in the buyback program if that goes through. Instead of being sold back to VMRC and being killed, those licenses could be put in full use again.
Good point. Other comments from the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Ken?
These numbers on, say, page 2, using this hard pot harvester, and you using the number of harvesters, is 776 the total number of harvesters, and of those 700 and some, 200 and some crab that, and then 139 crabbed, or is this a total?
The 776 is the number of harvesters who harvested from just over 0 days up to, looks like, about 45 days.
But that would be all harvesters for that year would be 776.
Well, this just is in that bin, right, row 7, so it's also based on, averaging it out.
That would be the average for those years, 776. That's the figure we're working with.
Right,
and then,
for that lower area of
and
harvest.
And 227 base. Of that 700, Graham.
No, that's they're additional.
That's additional. So you're saying altogether it averaged 1336? I mean, that's what it was? I mean, if you add them all,
yes,
that's what it comes
yes,
to.
Yes, it should be pretty close to that or a little less even, I think.
Well, I mean, I'm just curious as how we come about these numbers because in 207, they were only 200, and, I mean, it was only 726 people that actually sold a pound of crab or more.
That sounds,
I mean, that's by one of some
sounds
other
sounds too low, but, I mean.
That's by, I'm just using stuff
yeah.
that you supplied.
There's about 1,780 licenses prior to this waiting list situation. So, I mean, we could look at that, but that sounds too low. For 2007. But again, you've got 2004.
That was just from another piece of data I had
right.
that was given to us.
You have 2004 through 2007 data in here, and the way it works is if you worked in 2004 and 2006 and 2007, you're dividing by 3, essentially. So we'll be happy to look at that, Ken.
Thanks, Roy. And people have dropped out of that. I mean, that is 4 years of data. So
yeah.
Some people were in it for a year
lower.
And dropped out.
Yeah, it's
right.
going to be lower. I don't know if it'll be in the 700s.
Petrine?
Right. What is the amount of full-time crabbers that we have now after all the people that are taken out?
I don't know what a full-time crabber is. That's the eternal question.
Well, you're looking at one.
Well, you're still here. I know that.
100 days.
I think if you look, last time we looked at 110 days, I think, when we looked at this. So now, if you looked at 110 days, you're some portion of 115 crabbers. But that's just days worked. Maybe this should be in harvest rather than days worked. I mean, there are other ways to look at this data.
Yeah, I don't understand where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Because I know I worked more than 100 and some days, and I've worked there just about every day out there. And I can go back to my reports and count the days, and I know I'd weigh over 100 days.
Well, Pete, then you're out here at the right end of the tail. Ken?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we might have discussed this in an earlier meeting this summer, but you take up the bay, you know, it could be 20 to 40 days difference on both ends for the time that a man works.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, y'all start March the 17th down
yeah.
here. It'll be April, I mean May, before we even catch a crab up the bay.
Well, Rob, on the issue of the number of licenses, what I think you all did some recent analysis that indicated what the number of licenses was that caught the target over the last few years. What number is that roughly?
That's very rough because I don't have that off the top of my head. I think what you're referring to, I think what he's referring to is that situation that if you just set it to the yes.
They don't get that idea.
Yeah, that's so, in the 200s, I thought. Yeah.
Jack, the 250? I mean, the top 250?
If you took the 250 best crackers in the state and looked at their harvest on average of four of those times, those crackers alone could catch the target level of harvest. And you've got, what, would you say 1,700?
Licensees, probably about 1,300 and some active.
Okay. I think that's some important context. Now, that's against the backdrop of a resource that's at a low level that we're trying to recover, and hopefully that number obviously would go up as the resource is recovered. So.
Sure. Okay. Well, I mean, this whole process is looking at disequilibrium of the stock, and, you know, you clearly saw that in some of the things that Laura showed you going from 2006 to 2007, big drop. And then you go and you look at 2008, you get another drop, plus you have regulation. So it's not as if this is an equilibrium status right now.
Right. All right, Rob. Well, I guess the page?
The days of harvesters, the average days of harvesting of blue crabs, but isn't there some factor in there for, like, October and November when the crabber has decided to go oystering and he's removed himself from the crab fishery? That should have some impact in there somewhere.
Rob, it's not in there, and it's similar to what was brought up just a few minutes ago about the regional differences as well. This is strictly days reported by those harvesters. If you wanted to take this the next step, then we would have to take those kind of comments into the analysis, and you could look at a regional approach pretty easily here, and you could also look at maybe the harvest as well, because as I said earlier, we're just using days. You could probably use harvest and find out things that you wouldn't find out just by days worked. So it all depends on how far you take this.
Yeah, the oystermen have a big impact because, you know, right there in Rappahannock alone, we've got 25 of them. And they've removed themselves from the crab fishery at that point. And that's a significant amount.
This data in front of us is just reported days under the crab fishery. That's all right. So any other comments from the committee? It seems if I can just summarize the committee's concerns and Rob's concerns really relate to a potential increase in effort if license transfers occur. And again, we had wanted to explore this to see if it was a viable means of trying to mitigate the impacts of a 30% gear reduction to the individuals. Tom?
Two things. Number one is something you kind of said, and that is this is only looking at if we were going to take, say, the top 93 and say you could stack those licenses because they were full-time licenses. We can't get any more effort if you use them. If you go out of the fishery and give Pete your license, and now Pete's got two rigs he can use instead of one, so he's back up to 300 pots or 500 if he's in the main stem or however the rules work. If we were talking about taking somebody out of the fishery, that's where I would have a big concern over, so what else do they do as far as other commercial activities. The other question, Jack, having to do with this is the buyout is going to impact, and that's going to be and we should maybe wait till then.
My sense is almost been the last buyout on all of the transfers is that they slow down. Now, they always slow down from the consumer. People have heard that we're going to be buying licenses, and everyone has visions of big money, state coming in and buying them for a high price. So why would they transfer the license and sell it for X so they can sell it to the state for 2X or whatever. But I think that has sort of put everybody in a wait-and-see mode on these transfers. So even if we were to allow license stacking tomorrow, I'm not sure there'd be that much interest immediately.
Except for within family members and such.
Thanks, Jack. Let's move on to sponge crabs, if you have a presentation for us on that.
This is on the agenda for two reasons.
The number of phone calls that I have gotten from crabbers over the last 3 to 6 months has reached a threshold with me that caused me to put this item on the agenda. And those calls are from people that I consider to be full-time commercial crabbers who are saying to me, if you really want to save crabs, do away with the season closure and bushel limits and all the discussion about cull rings and that, and immediately stop the harvest of all sponge crabs. And they've called enough that I have told them, fine, we'll put this on the agenda of an advisory committee where it can be discussed by everybody in the industry, whoever wants to show up. It's going to be on the agenda. If you're interested in that topic, you'll be given an opportunity to speak. Whether or not those folks are here tonight, I couldn't tell you, but that's in part why it's on the agenda. Now, you know that the way we have chosen up to this point to deal with the sponge crab issue is through the sanctuary. You know, it's designed to protect pregnant females and prevent them from being harvested and brought out of the water. And we know from research that Rom and others at VIMS have done that when you harvest that crab and you bring it up on deck and you throw it back, lots of times the eggs die, and in some cases the female crab itself dies. So with that in mind, it doesn't make sense to us to prohibit the taking of all sponge crabs, but rather to protect them with this sanctuary that prevents that harvest process from occurring to start with. So I think we're approaching it the right way, but I get enough phone calls from people saying you're not approaching it the right way that it's on the agenda. The second reason it's on the agenda is there is this Senate Bill 1111 in the General Assembly that will affect the sanctuary. That I just mentioned. The bill is about halfway through the legislative process. It still has a ways to go, and it still has to be signed by the governor. The House did put an emergency clause on it, which means if it passes, that the law will be effective upon the signature of the governor, as opposed to waiting until July 1st to be effective. And what the law says is the historic crab sanctuary at the mouth of the bay that you're all familiar with will be closed immediately upon the signature of the governor. And it will stay closed forever unless the commission adopts a regulation to specify when that area is open. So assuming the governor signs it in March, that area will be closed at that point. And again, it will stay closed unless the commission comes in by regulation and opens it. Now, the remainder of the sanctuaries that go from that area to the Maryland line and from that area out into the ocean and down to Carolina are closed May 1 to September 15th. And, you know, whether or not you want this sanctuary closed those same dates or some other dates or year-round, we'll need some discussion from the committee on that. The idea last year when we established the seasons for the sanctuary were to move the closure up to May 1 as opposed to June 1 because there was evidence that crabs were in that area spawning in May. And in fact, the commission, I think, when they adopted the regulation, was under the opinion that this area described here in the legislation was actually going to be closed May 1 when in fact it wasn't. So that's where we are on the issue.
Jack, on the back on the sponge crab itself, we don't have any catch data on sponge crabs. I mean, our catch data is sex specific, but we don't have any biological monitoring data per se that would allow us to make an informed decision about what the effects would be. If we did that, you couldn't quantify it in terms of the savings, right?
Right.
Okay.
You could make some very broad assumptions, perhaps working with Rahm and, you know, others at VIMS about what percentage of the life cycle does it have some type of sponge on it and do some calculations there, but I think they'd have to be very rough.
Questions or comments for Jack from the committee on sponge crabs? Tom?
One is a process. This is passed the Senate without this clause, passed the House with the amendment that says it's an emergency regulation that goes to effect on signature.
Has not passed the full House yet.
Hasn't
it has passed. It has passed the House committee.
Oh, okay. It came out of committee that way. It could still get a floor amendment
if the House passes 1111 with the emergency. You'll have two versions of the bill now. You'll have the Senate version without the amendment and the House version with, and it'll have to go back.
It'll go back, okay.
For concurrence.
Right. To the Senate, okay.
Jack, what's the timeline on that? What's the earliest this might be law?
Well, the General Assembly is probably going to go home in another 10 days or so.
Right.
And then, you know, I think the governor could sign it in a matter of a couple of weeks.
Okay.
So it could very well be closed at the start of crab potting on March 17th.
But then the commission could open it with an emergency regulation. I think this would qualify. At their March meeting,
they could open it
at their March meeting and then close it again May 1st, which is their intent from last year. So worst case scenario, you have a 2-week period where it's closed.
Right. Other comments from the committee on either the sanctuary or sponge crabs? Joe?
On sponge crabs, I could. Jack, I know you said you got so many phone calls you don't count them anymore about taking the sponge crabs. I'd wager very good money that people are calling saying don't take sponge crabs anymore, or people come up Doug's way where they catch 95% males, just like I've sat through many meetings where a hard crabber said, you want more hard crabs? Stop catching peelers, because he doesn't have a peeler license.
Actually, some of the calls came from, most of the calls were coming from sort of the Gloucester area.
Well, Jack, you said you had had some public interest. I would just ask if there's anybody here from the public that wanted to speak tonight on this issue.
I got a question for Jack.
I don't know that anybody came. Pete?
Jack, when is the closure date for this?
As soon as the governor signs it. It's
in other words, it'd be closed for the not necessarily sponge crabs, for all crabs.
All crabs.
Yeah, well, that's kind of rough. I can see for the sponge crabs. I can't see all the clean females you're
going to
get.
I wonder if we could hear Johnny on the sponge crab.
Pete, do you know how many crabbers go into this area for the 45 days that is open in the spring of the year?
Did you hear that?
Yeah. A lot.
Okay.
A lot of people.
Ronnie?
What does it mean on the second page? Does it even have to wait for the governor's signature? So this is an emergency existence. This act is enforced from its passage. Does it still have to wait for his signature?
Yeah. That makes the emergency effective. That means it's effective the moment he signs it, as opposed to July 1st, when most legislation is effective.
Follow up.
So y'all could open the season under emergency legislation without a public hearing?
Correct.
Okay. That's right. And, Jack, on the issue of the sanctuary, as it relates back, at the beginning of the meeting we were talking about bushel limits and that being one management tool that would go into the mix. Obviously, this is one that went into the mix back in early 2008 when we were making regulations, and it was subsequently invalidated because we didn't have the authority to do that. Can you give us some sense of whether or not there's any analysis that can be done to show us what the conservation effect of the sanctuary is so that we could take that into account?
You'll recall the original discussions we had last year looked at a combination of cull rings and the spawning sanctuary closure and the peeler size limits. And
all of those together were about a 12% reduction of the 34%, 12 of it was associated with that combination of measures. And I don't know what percentage of that was associated with the total sanctuary. It was mostly the cull rings that achieved the biggest part of that. But obviously this area is quite small compared to the total sanctuary. And there's no water body designation that watermen can use to report harvest specifically from that area. Right. You know, the whole bay is just divided into quadrants. So we don't have an accurate, you know, assessment of the percentage reduction that will be gained now that this area will be closed May 1st, for instance.
But is it possible to at least make some assumptions and try to do some analysis prior to the next meeting?
Yes, it'll be, you know, less than 2%.
Okay.
Is what
Thank
you pick
you.
Up. Be very small.
One question.
Pete Freeman.
This is the old original.
1947.
Yeah. That's why I'm trying to figure out why the double shovel light didn't go into Cape Charles.
Yep.
And that be closed indefinite?
Unless the commission opens it by regulation, this says that area is always closed.
Come on up, Mark, and identify yourself, please.
Making like a million people crab hunting down here in the area, not crab hunting in Winham.
Mark, just state your name for the record.
Mark Sampson. And there's not really that many crabbers down there. Now, maybe up where you are, down on the Thimble and stuff like that, there might be a load of crabbers there. But I think there was like six of us out of Windhaven last year, you know. And they had a big report in the newspaper stating there was a ton of crabbers and this and that. And even when it was open, our catch was so low, it was ridiculous, you know. Crabs, they just went all up the bay. So I don't think it would get much gain as far as, you know, closing that, you know, conservation at all. And then on top of that, we're down in Windhaven. We're going to be basically shut into a small area, Windhaven River. You don't talk about a lot of congestion with crab pots being cut off, boaters, et cetera, et cetera. And eventually they're going to take that area and they're going to close it down completely. You know, so then what are we going to do? You know, I mean, we can go somewhere else. You know, I mean, we used to go to the ocean. Y'all shut that down, what, 3 years ago? Even after the data showed that the concentration of crabs were not down there at that time. You know, I think you need to reevaluate it.
That's smart.
I mean, that's how I feel.
All right, other comments from the committee? Joe?
Yeah, I just wanted to confirm something that Mark said. I've been crabbing out of Linhaven for 30 years now. And when I think what it used to be 25 or 30 years ago, from the time you left the entrance beacon on, there were literally thousands and thousands of traps out there. And last year and the year before and the year before that, there might be two or three lines or four lines out in front of Linhaven going all the way up toward Little Creek and all the way down toward Cape Henry. The concentration of crabbers out there really is minimal.
Thank you, Joe. Marshall?
This committee is not the place to fight this battle. The place to fight this battle is in Richmond. This committee has nothing to do with this legislation that's going to be passed. Then you go to Richmond and do this.
Thank you, Mark.
Can you explain that to these people? We have nothing to do with this. I am kind of interested in how staff feels about this proposal. Because I put a lot of stock in what Jack says. Sometimes it kills us, sometimes it helps us.
You'll recall last year, prior to last year, the entire sanctuary from Maryland to North Carolina was closed June 1st to September 15th. BIMS came in and said, we have evidence that pregnant crabs are spawning in that area in May. And so the commission agreed to back up the closure to May 1st. So now the area is closed May 1 to September 15th, with the exception of this triangular area mentioned in this legislation. It still closes June 1st to September 15th. Staff, for consistency purposes, staff is interested in having that area closed the same time the rest of the sanctuary is closed, so it's May 1 to September 15. So it would be our intent, unless we hear something differently from you all, we'd like to go to the commission once this legislation passes and see to it that this area in future years is open except for May 1 to September 15. So it would be open March 17 to the last day of April, and then it would reopen September 16 to the end of the year.
Thanks, Jack.
That would be, that's where staff is leaning on this. Yeah.
Chris?
So at this point, Jack, figuring this gets signed March 10th, are you prepared as staff to recommend at the March 28th meeting that we open it as of there by March 2nd?
Unless I hear you tell me something significantly different and it sounds good, yes, that's what we would do.
Joe?
It's my experience going out there March 17th is a waste of time. You're not going to see any crabs there until April anyway.
Yeah, I don't like
it. Okay, so that's not a big deal.
But what I would like to see, if possible, if the commission could vote on it, is when the time does come and they decide they're going to open it up, if they do, if they would extend it past the May 1st deadline and give a half mile from the beach out to crab after that is closed in the half mile point.
So close.
I don't think they can do that. You can't do that.
Yeah.
Not with this regulation. This says all you can do is change the dates.
Yeah.
Any further comment on the sanctuary issue? I've got Dr. McConaughey.
Oh, I was just going to say, I mean, one of the reasons that the commission looked at this is a valuable sanctuary because this is where all the females move through to go out and hatch their eggs out of the Cape. So it's kind of the bottleneck where the females move through. So if it's open, you can close all the other ones, but then it's open to be for those females to be caught. So that's one of the reasons it would be valuable to have it closed at the same time as the other sanctuaries.
Dr. McConaughey, Jack had originally said that he had some interest from various fishermen about the sponge crab protection. I know we've discussed over the last couple of years, the reproductive characteristics of the crab and the fact that they're now seen sponging out several times in a season in Virginia and many more times than that in more southern latitudes. Can you comment a little bit on that and the biological differential between clean females and sponge crabs?
Well, I mean, any mature female has been inseminated and has the potential to produce eggs. So, I mean, we're splitting hairs if we're just going to take the sponge crabs. I mean, if we're going to close it off, we probably ought to close it off for all mature females. There's some evidence that in Virginia, some of these females are producing 2-3 sponges. I mean, from tagging data, there's some suggestions that's happening. In North Carolina, they did a study. The crabs were in buckets in the water. They had an average of, I think it was 7, right, Ron? And then Dr. Hines from the Smithsonian did a thing down in Florida, and I think it was 11 or 12 sponges on some of them. So they have a potential to produce a lot more eggs. And so, obviously, as soon as you pull those mature females out of the water, that potential is over.
Right. Thank you, John. Other comments or questions from the committee on either sponge crabs or the sanctuary? You want to speak? You just state your name for the record, please.
Yeah, my name is Ray Wicker. I was just curious if they did that, what percentage would y'all figure that to your data of cutting back on your females?
Well, I think you heard Jack Travelstead say right up front that we don't have catch data on sponge crabs. And consequently, we'd have to make assumptions about what the impacts would be. We don't have any hard data in the reporting database to calculate a conservation effect.
So you could cut that off and still implement all the bushel regulations and everything.
Potentially, it's like some of the other regulations we discussed last year. It's difficult to account for. Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Pete,
you did allude to earlier the difference between 6% and 3%. And mention the fact of this sanctuary closure. Is that what you were getting at, Ray?
I'm just curious on the percentage.
Is it possible? Would it be possible that we could get 3% on this thing?
On closing the
sanctuary.
Original sanctuary for the month of May.
That's going to be subject to analysis. I mean, you'd have to look at it.
Or win it.
About 1 month.
No, I'm talking about if you, just like you showed us on the bushel scenarios, two different scenarios, either leaving it closed or just closing it for the month.
Yes, we can
deal with
that.
Tom?
So you're suggesting, I would say, maybe three options. Closing it in the spring. Now, I'm not suggesting any of these are good ideas, just but they're the ones that you should you should ask them to calculate. Close it in the spring, close it starting May 1st, and closing it year-round, which is what this code section does, without any input from the commission, or without any regulatory change.
Mr. Chairman, the other sanctuaries open up again in September, correct?
Right. September 16th.
And this one does, too.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah. Currently.
It's whatever you make it.
The legislation passes. It's
currently.
Closed until the commission sets the date.
Well, Jack, you'll bring that back to us at the next meeting, I assume, for discussion at that point, right? Rob?
I want to comment on the sponge crab that although you can't produce a harvest savings, you could produce egg savings. You could do an egg for recruit analysis. And back in 2000, we looked at this as a harvest savings, which is impossible to do because you know that those females can be harvested at some point. But we did go to industry. We called around. We had prevailing information of sponge crab distribution by river system five times starting in May and going through the season, I think, into September. But the problem was we couldn't show a harvest reduction. But at some point, if there's interest in looking at this for egg production, that's really the way it should be treated.
Thank you, Rob. Well, it sounds like we're waiting for further analysis on the sanctuaries for right now, and hopefully we can look forward to that at the next meeting, and the commission could consider that possibly for emergency action at the March meeting. Tom?
It's a question of what could the commission do, and I would suggest that the commission can petition the governor through the secretary that if he is going to sign this bill, that he do so ideally on the day the commission meets. He signs it in the morning. You can put the regulation in place. You're done. Or the worst-case scenario is he puts it in place the day after the March commission meeting, and then you're closed the whole month of April because they can't do anything till the end of April. So, I mean, unless you pull the commission in to do a special meeting just to do this emergency regulation, and I don't think that's going to happen.
Jack. All right.
But the commission could discuss that tomorrow.
Let's go ahead and move on to the disaster relief. Jack, do you have a summary for us?
I mean, is it possible to ask the secretary to go to the governor and ask him to sign the bill on May
1? He's going to have to sign it before the April veto session.
I think we'd expect it to be done within the next month.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead, Jack.
I think some of you already have copies of this document. Request that went to the National Marine Fisheries Service a few weeks ago. There's also a single page money sheet summary. Yes. Okay. We'll send you a copy of this in the mail.
All right, thank you.
Dan, do you have any further comments for the committee, Dan? Dan, thanks for joining us. Take care.
I'm not going to comment on this. It's, you know, take home and read it and study it. But this is the document that went forward to the feds for their consideration. We expect approval to come in two parts. The first approval will be for the off-the-water portions of the package. The on-the-water portions of the package will have to undergo a NEPA review, a National Environmental Protection Act review, which will take longer. And so I don't expect that we will at first get approval for some portions of the aquaculture and some portions of the marine debris removal projects and some of the research with coal rings. That'll come later. It eventually will come, but I would expect approval fairly quickly on the license buyout program and the stock assessment, which don't require activities, you know, on the water that might disturb the environment. But there is a fairly good description in the document. Ultimately, when we do get approval, we will be sending out a letter describing all of these projects to every licensed crabber. And the package will include applications and other mechanisms for them to express an interest in their involvement in any one of these projects, or if they want to put in an offer to be bought out of the fishery, that'll also be included. So that at some point, as we work out the details of all these things, there'll be a big package sent to every crabber in the state, including for some of this people that are on the waiting list, because there will be a provision to buy out some of the licenses from the waiting list.
Jack, would the buyback not be subject to NEPA review?
I don't think it will. Right. I don't think it will, because it's not an on-the-water kind of project. So Maryland got approval for their off-the-water projects in about 2 weeks of submitting their proposal, and that 2 weeks will be up sometime this week. So we could hear from them fairly quickly within the next, I think late this week, early next week.
Thank you. Questions for Jack? Ken?
Yeah. Jack, I've got no problem with 58 people making a living that day. But the last count I had, they had gotten back somewhere around 4,500 crab pots.
Yeah.
And just say with their less this time left, say they catch 5,000 crab pots, that brings the total cost to a pot at $300.
They're up to 5,000 now, but
all right,
I don't know where they'll be.
Let's say it costs $200, $250. Is there any kind of study that's been done to see if these derelict pots might actually be habitat out there instead of catching? I mean, you go look at the tank down at pool down at Vim's, they hide under. I mean, you can hardly see things in there, and especially when they rust a little bit and have an opening, it just looks like maybe they could be habitat, and I have a lot of the boys telling me that they're full of oysters. They've struck full of oysters when they bring them up. So I just wonder if there's ever been a study to see if these pots actually were.
Most of the studies that I'm familiar with document the losses from the pots.
I mean, been done to see if it's.
There's been a lot of marine debris of removal projects in the Gulf and in other states. And in fact, VIMS has done some work to document before that pot rots out and gets a hole so that things can come and go freely in it. You know, the things that are crawling in there are dying. You know, there's fish are starving to death and the crabs are dying and are destroying each other. And there are some estimates of the amount of resource that can be saved, but I don't know of any studies. Well, I'll ask Dr. Havens at VIMS if he's aware of any.
Thanks.
Document the importance of the habitat.
Thanks, Jack. Other questions for Jack?
Yeah,
Marshall?
This has nothing to do with what we're talking about. A target. We met our target goal.
Is this on Jack?
No, this is a question for Jack. I was wondering how Merlin has done with their same situation we do in our target.
You're talking about the harvest reduction target? The last I heard...
I brought it up last month to kind of find out what they're doing compared to what we're doing.
The last I heard, they had estimated they were somewhere in the, I think, 28% to 34% reduction in harvest.
Thanks, Jeff.
How did you accomplish that without crab dredging? I mean, where did all that come from?
Season closures.
What did they cut out?
Well, it was primarily season closures and I guess bushel limits. Yeah, I mean, they had a whole list of regulations which we can provide you.
Can you get up on there?
Sure. No female harvest.
Follow up on that question, Mr. Chairman.
Ken, go ahead.
Oh, you know, when Maryland first came out, they said that they only hit 15% to 20%. Then it was 20% to 26%, and then it was 28% to 36%. And just like you said, we underreport. All of a sudden, they overreport it.
Their watermen admitted to overreporting.
Yeah, but I don't know how you come up with an accurate figure of what Maryland actually did. I mean, Potomac River was, what, 26%?
We looked at Maryland provided us with their data as to how they calculated their percent reduction. And we looked at that.
Can I ask, does it seem kosher to you how they figured it out?
It did, yes.
I mean,
Ken, it appears that Maryland had some reporting effects. As you know, I think they went to the tiered bushel limit. The bushel limit was a function of history, and so suddenly your catching basis became important and relevant to your allocation, and it became allocative, and so it appeared that they might have had some reporting effects mixed into the results, and it's going to be hard to tease those up.
Also reported that they reported this data like that so that they could get their catch-up for the following year. I mean, I've never known a crabber to be able to conspire to get the price of crabs up 5 cents a pound. I don't know how you get all the Maryland's crabbers in Maryland to conspire to do that.
Does the committee have any more questions for Jack on the buyback program or the blue crab disaster relief? Pete Freeman?
Jack, I know that the crab is dredging is closed this year, and I think we have to vote on it again to close it next year or whatever. We don't. It's already closed 3 years, right?
The regulation doesn't have a sunset date on it.
Oh, okay. And I'm asking this, if it's going to go for 3 years for this ghost pot stuff, what are we going to do with that dredges and equipment that we got sitting up that's going to rust out? Are y'all going to buy that back?
It's not part of this package.
It should. It should be. It's $10,000 sitting on the shore rusting out.
Maybe you'll be able to use them at some point when the resource rebounds.
I've got let's stick with the buyback for right now. I've got Tom Powers.
Jack, there was when you talked to us last time about this buyback, you said that there would be three categories and the money would be split among those three categories. The people who are on the waiting list because of no effort or no reported effort, no reported landings, a people with a moderate amount of landings, and a people with a lot of landings. Have you come to any conclusion about how you're going to do that? And do you want advice from this committee on that?
No. Okay. We still have that work to do.
Other questions on disaster relief?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Ken.
I guess this goes to it because it was kind of brought up too. Are you saying that after 3 years and you get 200, you get a target abundance of 200, that dredging will be reconsidered?
I think so, sure. Why not?
Okay, I mean, that will go on the record that you said that.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I've said that all along.
Reconsider. All right, go ahead, Marshall.
I'm saying what the commission will
Marshall, is this on disaster relief?
Yes, it's on disaster relief.
Go ahead.
It is a disaster, Mr. Chairman. We want 200, that's our target, 200 million crabs.
That's the interim target.
Because a lot of watermen over homes are confused about dredging. It's my understanding that once we reached 200 million, for three consecutive years, then we'd do crab dredging again, or we'd look into it. Explain how that is. Is crab dredging going to be
Jack,
the regulation that closes the crab dredge season simply says the season is closed.
Right.
If the commission never does another thing, the season will always be closed.
Okay.
However, I mean, this is a management plan.
Right.
If the resource recovers, the code, the law that's in the code, says there's still an opportunity for a crab dredge season. And so it seems to me that if the population continues to improve and hits that interim target level of 200 million or goes above it, that's an opportunity to reconsider all of these regulations.
Thanks, Jack. Are there any other questions for Jack on disaster relief before we move on? We've got a presentation from Rom.
How come we can't continue to ask questions? I mean, you just stop.
Well, if you have a follow-up question on disaster relief, go ahead.
It's no disaster. Crowd drugs are a disaster. When we get to 200 million, then you'll be in support of opening crowd drugs.
No, I didn't say that. I did not say that.
That's what I'm trying to get at. A lot of folks call me about this. I mean, don't shut me up. A lot of people have called me and says, you know, when do you think crab drugs will be open? So I'm asking Jack, you know, and his opinion.
First of all, the $200 million is an interim level. Once the population hits that level, we know that the resource will be able to withstand a lot more harvest than it can now. We're at $120 million last year. We got to get up to $200
million. Okay.
The true target, that's why we've called that an interim target. The true target may be substantially higher than that when we consider the resource to be totally recovered. But certainly, if we stay at $200 million for 3 years, that gives us some sense of stability in the resource and a real opportunity to reconsider the entire regulatory package.
I understand 100%. Mr. Chairman,
okay. Marshall, go ahead.
In the last 10 years, how many times has it reached 200?
No. It hasn't been up to 200 since 1993.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Y'all heard that.
Right.
Yeah.
Was the last time it was.
And Jack, as early as the early 1990s, the population was over 400 million. So that might be more indicative of a long-term target.
Never going to be open. 98, not 93.
Right.
Thank you, Jack.
Thanks. Let's move on. We've got a presentation from Rom.
The person who's going to give the presentation is Megan Brook. She is a graduate student, has been working with Randy Chambers, another faculty member there, and myself on bycatch reduction devices.
Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hi. As Ram said, my name is Megan Rook, and I'm a master's student at the College of William & Mary. For the past two summers, I've been out in the marshes of the York River studying various aspects of diamondback terrapin conservation and ecology. And this past summer, we did a little pilot study looking at the effectiveness of bycatch reduction devices on crab pots the effectiveness of reducing terrapin catch, as well as what is this going to do to the crab catch. So that's want to present that today. This is the diamondback terrapin here. For those of you who aren't familiar, it lives in these nice marsh areas like this at the Goodwin Islands, if any of you are familiar with the Goodwins. It's the only turtle in North America to live exclusively in an estuarine environment. You have other turtles. You'll find them in the estuary, but they go in and out. The terrapin stays in the estuary the entire life cycle. It's found in coastal marshes from Massachusetts through the Florida Keys and the Gulf of Mexico, and has recently been discovered as a native inhabitant of Bermuda. It's an important predator in the marsh, as well as an important prey species. I'm going to talk about that for a little bit. The terrapin is a very important component of the marsh. It preys on shellfish, crabs, and salt marsh periwinkles, and about 80% of the terrapin diet is composed of the periwinkles. It does a great service to the marshes, keeping the periwinkle population down. It's also prey for bald eagles, toadfish, and large blue crabs. There have been studies that show that toadfish and the larger blue crabs will eat terrapin tails and limbs. So a healthy terrapin population contributes to a healthy marsh ecosystem, and this is important for crabs, but for other benefits as well. Most of you probably know that marshes protect our shoreline. They filter water coming off the land, protecting the estuaries and ocean from pollution and runoff. and marshes are important nursery habitats for fish and crabs. A little more about the terrapin. They are sexually dimorphic. The males are a lot smaller than the females. This is a fully grown male here on top, and that's a fully grown female on the bottom there. Okay. They're long-lived. They can live up to about 40 years. They have a late sexual maturity, 5 to 6 years for the males and 6 to 13 years for the females. The females can average about 5 to 20 eggs per clutch and can lay up to 3 clutches per summer. The average is about 2 clutches. And this is a female nesting here at the Goodwin Islands. And they will come back to the exact same spot to nest year after year. So this female has probably been nesting at Goodwin's since she was first able to reproduce. And all these traits combine to give the terrapin the designation of a K-selected species. There's a continuum of short-lived, big reproducers like the blue crab. Those are our selected species. K-selected species are these later maturing animals. They don't reproduce very quickly. And K-selected species, there have been several studies that show that they cannot sustain much harvest at all. So terrapin populations are declining across the entire East Coast for a whole number of reasons. It's your typical conservation story that you hear all the time. Habitat loss alteration, boat and car mortality, increased predation by subsidized predators, for example, raccoons and gulls, animals that live really well in human environments. Harvest, there was harvest in Louisiana and Maryland, however, the Maryland fishery is now completely closed. And bycatch. Now, of all these threats to terrapins, bycatch is the number one. In 2006, Butler et al. Identified crab pot mortality as the number one threat to terrapins in 6 states, including Virginia, and as one of the top 3 threats to terrapins in 5 other states. I don't know why. Our best guess is that terrapins just like crab pots. They like to go in these, and it's not just terrapins, all turtles. We actually, in the lab that I work in, we use crab pots to catch turtles. We modify them so the turtles don't drown, but it's the easiest way to catch a turtle. The threat of crab pot, it differs by use. So recreational crab pots are a huge threat, mostly because they're rarely checked, and they're right in the middle of the terrapin habitat. As I showed you in the introduction, terrapins live in the estuary, and you know, if you're just throwing a crab pot off your dock, you're right there in the middle of the marsh. And also, there, I'm not sure about in Virginia, but other studies have said that some people that have weekend homes, they'll set their pots on Sunday night and then not come back and check them until Friday night. And so even if it's in a very shallow area, if the terrapin's in a pot for more than 48 hours, even if it can breathe, it'll die of exposure. Commercial pots were initially not a threat to terrapins until the blue crab population began to decline and have forced the crabbers to concentrate effort more out of the main stem of the bay and up into the rivers and into the shallow areas. So this is becoming a bigger threat, but it's not nearly as big a threat as a recreational pot. And then, of course, there are ghost pots. These are recreational or commercial pots that have been lost due to storms, abandonment, whatever. This threat has not yet been quantified. However, there are some studies out there. One study found a single pot with 28 dead terrapins in it, and another study found 49 dead terrapins in a pot among other carcasses. And just a picture here off the NOAA website. These are all a whole bunch of terrapins that have crammed into this crab pot and have died, and there's some blue crabs in there too. Terrapins are not the only bycatch. These are the next couple slides. I'm going to show you some pictures of animals that we caught in my study. So water birds, this is I believe it's a clapper rail here. I don't know my birds very well. Aquatic rodents, that's a nutria, but we also got muskrat. Other turtles, we got mud turtles and snapping turtles. That's a mud turtle right there. And commercially valuable fish, this is a striped bass, but we also caught perch and croaker. So So several studies have proposed putting bycatch reduction devices on crab pots, and these are these orange plastic things right here on the entrances of the crab pots. Talk a little bit about those. They are required on all pots in Maryland and Delaware and on recreational pots in New Jersey. It's a 4.5 by 12 centimeter plastic. It's a really tough plastic thing that pretty much inhibits the entry of anything except crabs. And I only have the data on terrapins here, but I do want to make a point right now that all that bycatch I showed you were on our pots in our study that did not have BRDs on them. We had no bycatch in pots with BRDs. And they're relatively cheap, about 42 cents per BRD. These are commercially available right now. And so there have been studies looking at the effectiveness of keeping terrapins out. And I'll tell you right up front, they're pretty effective. I've got some data from my study. But this is why there's been a big push for this. However, there's very few studies on what this actually does to the crab catch. So that was the main focus of my study, was to look at what is this going to do to the crab catch. So I'll go through my experiment. This is the first of its kind in Virginia. My lab is pretty much, there's a lab on the eastern shore that's looking at terrapins, but we're pretty much the first lab to look at this. So it's pretty important for the council here. Right. We had two study sites in military bases. We didn't want to interfere with the commercial crabbing, and this also replicates a recreation, kind of, you know, where a recreational crabber would be setting his pots. So here is Fort Eustis. This is on the James River, and this is Fellgates Creek on the York River. It's part of the Yorktown Naval Weapons Station. We had 10 pairs of pot of two pots each, and these are the yellow dots here. I don't know how well you can see those. Each pair had one pot with a BRD on all four of its entrances and one normal pot. And we checked them fairly frequently. I'll get into that for a minute. I do want to say that there were no terrapins at Fort Eustis. We thought that there should be terrapins there, and me and my advisor and the biologist at Fort Eustis are all scratching our heads going, where are the terrapins? So I don't have any terrapin data from Fort Eustis, but we still have a lot of crab data there, and as I said, the crabs were the focus of our study. So just so you know that when I present the data, there we didn't get terrapins at Fort Eustis. Our sampling technique, we used a modified crab pot here. We put these chimneys on the top, and that was to reduce terrapin mortality, so the terrapins could swim up and breathe at high tide. Obviously, we would not ask a crabber to put this on their pot. This was just experimental design, but it was extremely important to reduce the terrapin mortality, and we do not believe that it had any effect on our results because we weren't catching anywhere near to capacity. We weren't even filling up the bottom of the crab pots with the crabs that we were catching, so it shouldn't affect the results at all. And then we put these little wooden stakes on there, too. We couldn't get out there sometimes for 3 days, so we would prop them open, and anything that got in there could get out. We checked for terrapins twice a week as part of my broader study. And for terrapins, we looked at the effect of BRDs, and we also looked at date just to see if there were some confounding effects there. We looked at that for the terrapin catch. And then we baited and checked for crabs once a week for 4 weeks. As I said, this was a pilot study. We don't have a lot of data, but that's... So we have 4 data points for the crab study for each site. We did a very extensive analysis of this, though. We looked at the effects of BRDs, date, and site on the number, size, and biomass of crabs caught. And then we split number, size, and biomass into total legal size crabs and sublegal size crabs. All right, so the terrapin data, I'll go through that first. And I will say right away, the date had no effect on our catch for terrapins, so I didn't present the results here. But as far as BRDs, what we have here on the x-axis is our average number of terrapins per pot per day. I'm sorry, the y-axis. On the x-axis is date. The gray indicates our average terrapins that we caught per pot per day in non-BRD pots, our standard crab pots. And then the green is the average number of terrapins we caught per pot per day with pots with BRDs on them. So we had a total of 48 captures for the entire summer. 46 of those were in pots with non-BRDs on them, and two were in pots with BRDs. There are very little terrapins, and those are the green right here. I don't know how well you can see that. So that turned out to be a 70 to 100% reduction. And just a note there, 46 terrapins that were caught in a non-BRD pot, that's about 14% of the estimated population in Felgates Creek in the weapons station. So if these terrapins had died, that would be a significant reduction in their population every summer. So the take-home message is here, BRDs worked really well, which we were expecting because other studies have showed this. Now the important stuff, the crab catch. What did it do to the crab catch? I'll walk you through this here a little bit, and I'm only presenting the data on legal crab catch. In the interest of time, I do have the rest of the data, though, if anybody would like to hear about that. So on the y-axis here, this is a couple different things, actually. This bar on the left here is our estimate for the average number of crabs per pot per day, our CPUE. And then the other three bars here are the change that we got based on the variable. So we'll take the BRD. Here we got just over 0.6 crabs per pot per day in a standard crab pot without BRDs at Fort Eustis on the very first day. Putting a BRD on it really didn't do much at all. It may slightly increase the number of crabs caught per pot per day, but I'm estimating that it really doesn't do anything at all. We saw a much greater effect by date. We got slightly more crabs every week, and then Felgates had a lot more crabs, so we caught more crabs there. So you would take each of these three and then add it on top of the estimate here. So, again, I don't think that BRDs actually had much of an effect at all on the crab catch. If it did have any effect, it's either going to be lost in this difference that you would normally see in your date or site-to-site change anyway, or it might slightly increase the catch. Same thing for legal size crabs. We had an estimate of about 13 for our average size crab, legal size crab that we caught, 13 centimeters. And again, BRDs had relatively no effect. If anything, just the tiniest, slightest increase. Date had no effect, and then at Fort Eustis, the crabs were just a little bit bigger. So again, if there is an effect, it might get washed out in these other effects that you would normally see from date or site, or there might be a slight increase. The exact same thing with biomass. We got about 97 grams was our estimate for our average crab, single crab that we caught, and the same thing with BRDs, date, and site. So the major conclusions from this pilot study is that I believe the BRDs on crab pots would be very, very beneficial to wildlife and potentially beneficial to watermen. The BRDs will likely have no effect on the crab catch, but could cause a slight increase in the numbers, size, and biomass of crabs caught. BRDs on recreational pots would significantly reduce terrapin mortality and as well as other bycatch. BRDs on commercial pots could reduce bycatch of numerous species, including commercially valuable species such as striped bass, croaker, and perch, and also crab predators such as striped bass or blue catfish. I didn't catch any blue catfish, but I've heard of other people getting blue catfish in their crab pots. So I just want to run through the benefits versus the cost real quick, and then I'll wrap up here. So the benefits, they're very effective at reducing the terrapin bycatch, as well as other bycatch, including valuable species and crab predators. It helps maintain a healthy marsh ecosystem. It's a relatively cheap one-time purchase. No new pots are needed. You can just buy the BRDs, stick them right on the pot, and again, they're hard plastic. They will last the entire life of a crab pot. There's no decrease in the number, size, or biomass of legal crab catch, and there could be a potential increase in the number, size, and biomass of legal crabs. Cost, a one-time cost of 42 cents per BRD plus shipping, so, you know, less than $2 per pot, and a one-time effort input to put the BRDs on. It might take a little while. It did take us a while to put them on, but you only do that once. So, again, this is a pilot study. We don't have a whole lot of data, but I do feel like I have enough data at this point to make a small recommendation. I think that right now it would be reasonable to require BRDs on all recreational crab pots. This is not going to cost a recreational crabber much of anything. And as I said, these pots are right in the middle of terrapin territory, so it would be very beneficial for all the wildlife in the marsh. And then conduct a broader, more commercially applicable study to the effectiveness, benefits and costs of BRDs on commercial pots. I was expecting that there wasn't going to be an effect at all, and we did find the possibility for a slight increase, so I think this is worth looking into to see if you're in an area where you're catching more crabs than we weren't catching many, to see if this plays out, if this is something that could possibly help the commercial fishery. All right, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Megan, thanks for your presentation. at the beginning of your presentation, you pointed out that the terrapin population was in decline,
mm-hmm.
and you cited some factors related to that.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a formal population assessment of the terrapin population?
Not in Virginia. I was working on that. We just don't have the data for that in Virginia. As I said, we're my lab that I work in is pretty much the first in Virginia to study this. In Maryland, they do have that data. They've been tagging, recapturing, and studying terrapins for about 20 years. I don't know the numbers from that study, but it is available for Maryland, and I believe in New Jersey as well.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Questions for Megan?
Yeah.
Marsha?
What type of bait did you use?
Menhaden.
You need tri-crab.
I'm sorry?
You need tri-crab.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Most time when I catch these, there's old crabs in there that's dead, and that's what they go to eat. You try that.
Okay.
Questions for Megan on the presentation? Johnny?
Did I hear you say that Maryland requires these? Is this for the commercial or the recreational?
I read a paper. See, I thought it was just for the recreational, too, but I read a paper that with a legal commentary from Willem Rosenberg, who is the main researcher in Maryland, from 2008 that said it was required for the entire fishery, commercial and recreational. So that's where I got that information from. But I was under the impression that it was just a recreational requirement.
No. This is supposed to go.
Yeah, but that's not what I'm talking about.
Well, I would think if it was regulated on the commercial level that you would have data to support what it did in that fishery in that state, and hopefully it would correlate what you've shown us here. But
right. It's new, though. I mean, they don't have many.
More importantly, they don't allow crab potting in the tributaries of Maryland. And yet your case was about the habitat and the salt marsh and,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's what we crab in here in Virginia. That's the area where we concentrate most of our crabbing efforts with that type of gear, where Maryland is the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So it's funny that they might put something like this in mm-hmm. in areas that are in deeper waters, and you'd think the habitat, the turtles would be in that habitat and not so much in the areas where you'd least suspect of it. Do you find them in deep water? Does it...
I didn't do the study in deep water. I know that in early spring they are out in the seagrass beds, they're out in the deeper water mating in the spring. And then throughout the summer they do move into the shallower areas to feed and to nest and then in the winter they hibernate. So they're down in the mud in the winter.
Tom Powers?
You suggested that in the intertidal areas where the pot's out, they can survive for longer periods of time and die of exposure after 48 hours. If the pot is such that it's always submerged,
mm-hmm.
what's their life expectancy once they get in a pot?
At 4 or 5 hours.
So even a commercial activity where they check the pot once a day is just as bad. And as Johnny said, most of right now, especially with the main step closed during the summer, we've got these giant sanctuaries in the middle of the bay. Almost all the effort has moved into the tribs
mm-hmm.
and the rivers. So I start to wonder, where we should, if something was implemented, where it should be implemented on a body of water basis overall if we're really trying to protect these.
Let's see.
Mr. Jenkins?
Yeah.
Ron, is this the same size that you sent up to us?
Yes, it is.
Well, I hate to pop your balloon, but we tried them in crab pots and peel pots. The catch in the peel pot was it was hardly noticeable. They caught the same with them or without, but they did prevent the catfish from going in there. However, the ones we put them in the crab pots, it did limit the harvest of the larger crabs. So I can't understand why you say it helped the crab pots. You had an increase in it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, if you was crabbing up in a ditch, you know, I don't know what bearing that would have. I call it a ditch, a little creek or stream, whatever. But for us crabbing in the river, it did cut our catch back, I would say, 30% with that ring. If that was the same size one you used. Now, if you used a bigger one, then I could see the difference.
Mm-hmm.
But during the whole summer that we fished our pots in the Rappahannock, we probably caught 3 terrapins. And we fished sometimes we was close to shore or to the marsh, is that wall back there. Just, you know, sometimes we didn't. Not always, but sometimes.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, and I certainly hate to say this, but Thames put out a bulletin, or it was in the paper, 4 or 5 years ago, the importance of periwinkles in the creeks, because that was the main food source for the blue crabs.
Uh-huh.
And you said earlier that terrapins ate most of those.
Now, most of the terrapin diet is composed of the periwinkles. They're not crashing the periwinkle population or anything like that. They may help to keep it under control so the periwinkle population doesn't explode, which could be a problem for the marsh. It could potentially kill the marsh. But they're not reducing the periwinkle population.
All right, Peter.
You didn't by chance bring one with you.
No, I don't have one here.
Well, what in the world is wrong with
you?
Yeah.
Do a follow-up, Peter?
Okay.
Joe?
Yeah.
You said the average weight of the crab's biomass was 90 grams?
97 grams.
97 grams.
That was a big business.
I'm just 97 grams, about a 3.5-ounce crab.
Yep.
I'm not too good with the
U.S. That was big. So if you're looking at a 3.5-ounce crab, you're looking at about 110 pounds per bushel. That's
crab. Not a very big crab.
Okay.
It's 454 in a pound.
So that would be average catch. That was the average biomass catch instead of legal crabs.
Yeah.
Do you have a follow-up on that point, Joe? Okay, I've got Pete Freeman.
I have a little question first. I'm crabbing in Lafayette River. I crab all the way up to Tidewater Drive, and it's nothing but marsh and a little stream. I've been crabbing about 40 years. You know how many turtles I've caught? 2 in 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see why I crab by this definition to killing the turtles. I can't see that. And I see a clam on top of the water swimming, but I never caught it.
Right.
Got 2 in the crab marsh.
And you're in the deeper water, right?
No.
I mean,
no, you can't float it there on low tide.
Okay.
Marshall?
I'm just curious how you determine that recreational pots do more damage than the commercial. It's more turtles.
I was assuming that it was because it's in terrapin habitat. And there have been some other studies in Maryland, particularly, that have supported that.
You're probably absolutely right. Something needs to be done in recreational parks. I'll make a motion on that baby right now. let me hear a second.
Any additional comments from the committee, Tom?
Towards the recreational problem, or it being perceived as a problem, I think you go back to Maryland. They don't allow commercial crab pots in the tributaries.
Mm-hmm.
They do allow 2 recreational pots on a private pier.
Mm-hmm.
So you could easily see where the data would be biased in Maryland towards it's a recreational problem. Whereas in Virginia, like these guys are saying, you go up into any of the creeks, all the way up into shallow water. Normally, if somebody's got a string of pots out there, at low tide, you can see the top of the pot.
Okay. I was not aware of that. I was under the impression that the commercial fishery here, they
go around Plum Tree Island sometime during the summer.
I've got several comments out here, Jack.
Bring to your attention the Crab Disaster Fund package that I handed out to you. We'll provide additional funding to continue this research using water meat, make use of these devices and collecting data around that.
Ron?
Quick little answer. I'm not sure you could consider the Elizabeth River sort of a model system for the rest of the bay. I wouldn't be surprised if there are Murray terrapins in there. But a couple things that you need to consider. First, one of the real concerns we have for the long-term future of the crab fishery is the fact that if the terrapin were to become listed as threatened, it could potentially close down the crab fishery. So it's not a minor issue. Secondly, we are formally, from BIMS, I am asking that you consider recommending BRDs for recreational crab pots. And I say that because the inference is that crab pots by the recreational crabbers are in very shallow waters. They're all in the marsh systems. Let me just finish with that. And it's clear that these BRDs reduce the terrapin catch. They clearly do. They don't appear to have much of an effect. It's a very cheap fix for the recreational crabber who only has a couple crab pots. So I think this is something that would be totally, completely conservation-minded by this committee. On the commercial side, we do not want to make any sort of recommendation whatsoever until we conduct a broader study, but we conduct it in the shallow areas throughout the bay so that we get answers to some of the questions like what Doug has posed. So we are not proposing anything whatsoever for the commercial side right now. We would like to, again, expand the study. We're going to do part of it with disaster relief money, but we would ask that you consider the recreational BRD as a recommendation.
Ron, thank you. Now, this study, though, that we've seen here is the first study of its type. I mean, this is a pilot study in Virginia.
First study in Virginia.
Right.
But it's been conducted in a couple other locations in the U.S., and they have the same results everywhere as far as terrapins, as far as the mortality. The crab catch is, you know, it goes either way. In general, there's not that much of an effect.
Can you give us a sense of when the next study would be completed? That is a larger scale project?
This year.
End of this year?
Right.
Okay. So you might have more data for us to consider for Virginia
data. Later,
we'll
have the data. And actually, we're going to have one of the reasons that the class is here. They're actually going to conduct a cost-benefit analysis with your own information in terms of what kind of cost, if this were to be implemented for commercial crabbers only in shallow areas now, only in shallow areas, and shallow is just a few feet, then there's going to be an actual business plan produced that says, okay, here's how much it's going to cost you. Here's what you expect to gain or lose in a crab catch. Here's what the expense is going to be for putting it on. And then hopefully the committee will have everything in front of them from the conservation as well as the economic effects. That's for the commercial side. And so we really don't want to go into much further discussion until we conduct that study. The class will have the economic study. But the recreational one is something I do ask you to consider right away, because this is a serious matter, and there's no doubt that it has had benefits for the terrapins.
Okay. Thank you, Ron. Jack, hang on, Marshall. Jack, could I hear from you on this? We've been presented with a pilot study, and we have a fuller study ongoing this year that would have the results of this fall in terms of considering it for rulemaking before the commission. Would we not want to have a fuller review of data to entertain in the later in the year? Well, if this committee referred that to you for review while this other study is ongoing, would that be a suitable course of action that we could then bring back to the commission. Okay. Other comments from the committee or questions? Megan, thank you for the presentation. I appreciate it. Ron, thank you for bringing this to our attention. At the end of the last meeting, we're still on new business. At the end of the last meeting, Ken Smith had asked if staff would review some environmental factors affecting the blue crab fishery, and Ron Lipschitz actually responded to that question and indicated that he's developing a or working on the development of an ecosystem management model, and indicated that we might have a report in 3 months. Ron, was that? I was just commenting at the end of the last meeting. You responded to one of the questions from the committee regarding environmental factors facing the blue crab, and you indicated that a team of biologists around the bay were working on a to develop an ecosystem-based management model. Are you going to still plan to have a report for us in a few months?
What we're doing right now, we're going to have our first, our second team meeting come the first week in March, or actually the second week in March. And then we should have the at least the biological and or ecological study done in, within a few months of that. So, and then we'll be moving on towards the ecosystem-based plan. What we're doing right now is we're actually moving a bit faster on the striped bass ecosystem-based management plan. Most of the preliminary work has been done on the striped bass. Now the there are four teams that are going to look at all the information that's come forward. So we're doing that first. In the meantime, we're collecting all the information for the blue crab. So this process is moving along. By the end of the year, certainly we'll have a fairly extensive report for you on that.
Thank you, Ron. I know we had a couple of speakers out here. I think I missed Dirk. Did you have a comment?
Dirk Sanford. I actually had a question about the disaster relief plan. I was wondering why none of this money has gone to educating the crabbers, putting some, you know, sending them to some kind of vocational school or college or some other kind of job training. And my other question was how about the people that work on crab boats too, the helpers and stuff? What's being done for them?
Thanks, sir. Jack?
There is a bill in the legislature that requests that some of the disaster money be used to provide tuition to crowders at technical schools or community colleges. And it's not included in the package I handed out today because we weren't sure whether the legislation would pass. But the intention was, if the legislation passes, we will submit an amendment to this document through the National Fisheries Service to allow that to happen.
Jack, has there been what's the status of the bill right now? Is it?
I think it's moved right along.
Okay. Thank you.
Go
ahead, Dirk.
Asking about the crabbers, helpers. And
right, I don't think there are provisions in the current plan for helpers.
Everything is, I mean, as much as you can see here, is going to be targeted for licensed crabbers. Now, obviously, the guys are doing the ghost pot recovery are using mates on board their vessels for most cases. And they are, you know, we're paying the captain of the boat.
Thanks, Jack. Thank you, Dirk. Is there any additional business to come before the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Ken?
I've got a couple of things, but first, if we could go back to this this device going into the crab pot.
BRD?
Yeah, I'd like to make a motion that Megan present that to the commission tomorrow. And, I mean, VMRC is the advisory of the commission, and have her make that that same presentation tomorrow and ask for the for the recreational part of it to be put in recreational pots. So if it is going to be done, it can be advertised for 30 days.
Well, Ken, I think we just said that there's an ongoing study right now for this year on BRDs on a larger scale basis that would give us more data, and that would give Jack and staff an opportunity to review the data by commission staff before the commission considers it for rulemaking. So, and that's what Jack had agreed staff would do.
The motion has been made.
Right, but I think we've already moved on this item, and staff's going to review it. And we can come back if you want to try to have that staff review by next month. We can do that.
Follow up to that.
Go ahead, Ron.
Is Ron not considered part of staff?
And Jay?
I mean, he's advisor to staff, and he requested it.
Right. He did.
You agreed with Jack that that's what it done. The committee, this commission committed it.
Right, but the committee
didn't. The one that agreed with Jack that that's what it would do.
Okay, well, there wasn't any objection at the time, and we moved on.
Okay.
You may have I mean, a motion has been made.
Right, and I haven't recognized the motion at this point.
You haven't recognized it.
That's right. Ron, did you have a comment?
My personal preference, what I just discussed with Jack is that we're going to give VMRC staff a full report on the recreation, on the BRD, and relative to the recreational BRD, so that by the next meeting, over the next 3 to 4 weeks, then you'll have both our recommendation and VMRC staff's recommendation. So personally, I think that's the prudent way to approach it, to wait the next 2 to 4 weeks. You don't have to wait more than that, but I think that would be prudent.
Thank you, Ron. Jack?
Just so we understand the procedure, and it has nothing to do with this study. The monthly agendas of the commission are set 2 weeks in advance by the commission. And so he would not be too happy with his suggestion to modify that agenda, I'm sure.
Somebody
asked that question.
I got to ask.
So, Jack, you're going to work with Rom to review the data and report back to this committee at the next meeting. And at that point, this committee can act on that and refer it to the committee to the commission for action.
Well, I have two questions, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Marshall.
If we can't act on anything tomorrow, why do we have a crab meeting tonight? And my second question is, I am chairman of a Northampton County Wetlands Board, and I ain't never ignored a motion. And when someone makes a motion, I just can't say that. That's forgot about. Can you explain that to me, Mr. Chairman?
Absolutely. Just as a point of order, we had moved on from that agenda item, and we were in a new business, and then you want to reopen the business for another agenda item that we had already passed over, and it's simply out of order. But we had already acted on it. Staff's going to review it. I think you've heard now that staff is going to report back to us on your second question, and this committee can just discuss and deliberate that at that point in time and refer it back to the commission for action. And on your first question, we're taking into consideration all the different factors that would go into the rulemaking for 2009, and we want to start deliberating those to understand your preferences and begin to form some sort of consensus as a committee about what direction we might want to take after the dredge survey comes out in April, so that we're positioned to deal with that as a commission and a committee. Thank you.
New business, Ken. Still. And you've said it yourself, Mr. Chairman, that the crabbers are, I don't know what the correct word is, but there's a lot of doubt about the winter dredge survey. And I think it was mentioned three times in the minutes from last month. During our meetings back in the summer, we were told that there were going to be watermen on the winter dredge survey this year. And there, I mean, I know it, but at least two meetings that took place in that we were told we'd have watermen on those winter dredge surveys, and we have yet to see them. And I'd like to know what can be done about that, or if anything is going to be done about that.
Thank you, Ken. Rom, could we have some discussion about the outreach that we discussed earlier in the season?
Sure. Ken, we would, what we were planning on doing is having a one-day, and you can tell me if you think this is fair or not, basically to have a one-day demonstration of exactly how we conduct the survey. We wanted to limit it to the York River just for the sake of logistics. Just, you know, we would load up by VIMS and then take you out somewhere there in the York River and show you. So the plan is to set that day up in what we were hoping to do is to get done with the dredge survey itself, which should be done within the next couple of weeks or so, and then advertise and have a day where we do that. We think it would be the fact is that we need to get that data as soon as possible, and so we didn't want to disrupt the regular dredge survey. The weather's been disruptive enough at this point. So if you're comfortable with that, then that's the idea, is to set something like that up in about 2 to 3 weeks. And we were leaving it open because we didn't know exactly when we'd finish the dredge survey.
Ken, on that? Sure.
I mean, I guess, you know, that's what's been done for this year, but I would like to see something set up for next year that, you know, there is a waterman involved in it, or maybe three watermen, one 4 week here, one, so that the word gets out up and down the bay. And I mean, it gets rid of a lot of doubt. Right now, right. There is a lot of doubt, and we looked at what was in here, and Rom and I've talked about this, mm-hmm. and I mean, I personally find it hard to believe you can count every crab in the bay, but I understand and I appreciate what you're doing. But even in here it says that there's a correlation between the winter dredge survey and the harvest. And I just think it would help answer questions. And if there are questions that the watermen have that might doubt it, it might be better ways to do it that the watermen would have an input.
Ken, I would agree. I mean, I think we've had a lot of people come in here, and from the conversations we've had in the past, I mean, there's a lot of misunderstanding about the survey. There's obviously a significant opportunity for education and input as well. So I think that ought to go both ways. But I would certainly from this seat support the development of a more robust educational and outreach type initiative for next year. But it sounds like Rom is willing to try to accommodate this year.
Well,
we'll try
to firm up a date. I mean, our problem is trying to, as I said, we wanted to make sure we finished the actual dredge survey. By the way, just to clarify one thing, we use the dredge survey to predict the landings.
Yeah.
And it's done a pretty good job over the years. So,
Go
ahead.
Do you go on with them around?
I have been.
I mean, you're not.
It's my staff. No, it's my staff who are out there doing it.
I didn't know if you were just waiting it out.
Yeah. No, I've been out there doing it.
So I'm up at Smith Point a couple weeks ago, and I just wondered.
They'd like me out there more.
The routine of doing it, to run north, do a drag, and then run about 7-8 miles back south, do a drag, and then come back within a half mile where he did his last one.
Well, we usually don't do that unless there's a tide issue or something. But
fuel must have been cheap, right? Yeah. Go ahead.
Clarify me on something. You just said that the winter dredge survey is to predict the harvest?
Right. That's what we've used it. That's where we get a very high correlation between the one-year-old crabs and older. Well, actually, it's a total catch in terms of predicting the harvest. So all the crabs that we get in a particular year predicts the harvest fairly well in that year.
If that's, I mean, then why do we say there's 120 crab abundance if what you're doing is predicting the harvest?
That's because that's the population estimate. That's the larger crabs. The 120 million number is one-year-olds and older. And we use the complete data set to predict what's going to be susceptible to harvest that year or available to harvest.
Rom, the survey does both. It estimates the population and allows you to predict the harvest.
Correct. It estimates the population at the beginning of the year and then provides a prediction.
No, I mean, because we see this line and we see all these numbers saying this is what we got. So I was curious about that.
Well, I mean, I'd be happy to prepare a presentation for you at some point to show you exactly how we do that. That wouldn't be a problem. If you want, I could even prepare something for you for the next meeting. Although we'll probably have the day out on the dredge survey before that.
Rom, could you go ahead and plan to do that? I think would benefit as a committee from that discussion.
Which one?
A presentation.
Sure.
At the next committee meeting. Thank you. Are there any additional questions of Rahm, or is there any additional business to come before the committee?
May I just make one other comment? By the way, the study that we're referring to with the call rings and with the BRDs, that's going to employ crabbers specifically. So we're going to do it in conjunction with the crabbers. It's not going to be a separate scientific study by itself.
Thank you, Rahm. Any additional business to come before the committee? Yes, sir.
My name is Don Miles from Eastern Shore. Our crab pot on the bay and the seaside boat, and the crabs caught on the seaside, are they added into the total catch for the state of Virginia?
In the total catch?
Yeah, the total bushels caught.
Yes, they are in the total state.
Why isn't
there
a dredge survey done on the seaside so that population can be added? You're talking from the state line to the bridge tunnel, a lot of bottom and a lot of crabs. I mean, I wouldn't guess. I mean, I probably catch 1,000 or so bushels. And I just was wondering why, if those crabs are added and not counted, then your math is totally off. Has to be.
Don, you ask a question on survey design, really. I'll ask Rahm to address that.
Why isn't done over there?
Yeah. Rahm, can you address that?
Well, I think it'd be directed to Rahm.
Okay. Rahm.
The one we don't stop. It's a unit stop in the Chesapeake area, the main stem, our cribs, all the way up the bay. The seaside area is not considered part of that unit stop. There's probably a little debate here and there about how much mixing there is, but the catch on a statewide basis is very important for us and for our management purposes. For those who do what's called the stock assessment, the analytical stock assessment, to get the abundance, the exploitation, that is based on Chesapeake only. So our Chesapeake area, Maryland, added in the Potomac, all that's part of that unit. So that's the scientific part of using the data. The practical purposes, the seaside is very important for us for management.
Well, if their numbers are added to this and are not surveyed, so you don't know actually how many crabs are. Really. Common sense.
But the stop on the Eastern Shore is not part of the Bay stop.
Cape Charles is part of the Chesapeake Bay. I crab there. Yeah, but you added them into the total number for the total state.
The management plan is the management plan for the Chesapeake Bay stop. And the 34% reduction that we were trying to achieve was for the Bay stop, not Bay plus Ocean.
We're under the same regulations.
Not always. Some of it's different.
Other than two culverts.
And you're peeling those.
Well. I've yet to see that enforced.
Thanks, Don.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. Any additional business come before the committee? Seeing none, we're adjourned. Thanks for coming.